Tonight on The Download, former Chicagoan and author Rich Cohen, filmmaker Sean Baker, and another installment of The Swap Meet with Greg Lamb. And now, here's your host, a man who just got 8,500 points in Just Dance 4, Justin Kaufman.
That's a lot of points for me faking like I'm dancing on Wii U, but I did it, so are you proud of me? Hey, everybody, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Got a great show lined up. Mike Fouché is going to join us this hour. We'll talk a little bit about the story that's been going around, a great piece by Darlene Glanton in the Chicago Tribune, pushing back on the notion we hear over and over and over that Chicago has the strictest gun laws in America. Mike Fouché will talk a little bit about that. We'll get to the bottom of what that actually means and if that's accurate, because at one point it was. There's no doubt about it. But laws have changed, including concealed carry in this state and in this city. And if you look at it now, it's not the case. So we'll talk with Mike about that, but we'll also talk to him about what's going on with the Chicago Police Department and overtime, also a discrimination suit about how the police deal with the disabled. So lots to talk about, as well as a mass exodus of legislators from the General Assembly as the election comes up. I think the count right now, Pete, is 29 lawmakers in the General Assembly have decided they don't want the job anymore. They're walking away. They're going for a different job, or they're just out. 29. That's a lot. It's a big number. Talk with Mike about that. Coming up at 8 o'clock, as we mentioned in the crosstalk, Sean Baker, filmmaker, who did Tangerine. It was a big hit. Sundance, a film that was shot only on iPhone. Has a new film out called The Florida Project. It is about the hidden homeless. Willem Dafoe is the star. It's coming out this weekend. It's getting great reviews. Very depressing film about the hidden homeless, people who live on the fringes of Walt Disney World and in Orlando. And if you've ever been to that area, you know what I'm talking about, the outskirts of the park where there are motels and budget motels that are almost dressed up like Disney World to get people's attention to stay here, budget motels. Those have fallen out of favor, and this is a true story as well as fictionalized in the movie. They've fallen out of favor, and they've become these extended stays for people who are living paycheck to paycheck or week to week, single mothers, families, people who are down on their luck, addicts, and everybody in between that needs a place to stay. They don't classify as homeless, but it's a serious situation, and this movie looks into that issue. So we'll talk with Sean Baker coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. In the 9 o'clock hour, what should be preserved? Be an interesting conversation about architecture, but also just the concept of what in our society should be preserved. It always, we talk about buildings and other things, but it's just a more ethereal conversation about when we start to think about preservation. What does it mean? What does preservation mean to you? Tanner Woodford will be here. We'll talk with him. Also, Rich Cohen's on the show tonight, the longtime author, has a new book about being a Cubs fan and how that has shaped his life, and how winning the World Series and defending the World Championship this week will change it and has changed it. So we'll talk about that. And, of course, Greg Flam will be here to do the swap meet tonight where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, and your junk. All that coming up tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. President Trump was in Las Vegas today telling victims and first responders that we, quote, will never leave your side. Not much more on the investigation except to say that the shooter's girlfriend was interviewed by the FBI in Los Angeles after returning from the Philippines last night. She released a statement through her attorney saying she knew nothing of what her boyfriend was planning and came back to the States to cooperate in any way possible. Authorities and officials right now debriefing reporters in Las Vegas. Rob Martier will have the details in upcoming newscasts. The White House continues to tell reporters that the president will discuss gun control at the appropriate time, although some wonder if that's actually a stall tactic and the playbook when it comes to this topic. Where would they get that idea? All right, from every other mass shooting we've had in the last couple decades. Many columnists, including right here at Chicago Tribune, John Cass and Sean Hannity, have bemoaned the, quote, left for sweeping in and politicizing this tragedy. But it's hard for me to buy that, only because the president himself is quick to tweet, told you so, when there's an international terrorism incident, even when it's fresh. And I also don't buy this left argument. I think that's part of the problem right now. Words like that. Is it really a left issue or is it an American issue? I don't know anyone from the left that's ever argued for the complete abolishment of guns in this country. I think all Americans are wondering if we should be thinking about military-style weapons and accessories in the hands of civilians. I mean, these are weapons that are made for killing people. So if you don't have a reason, if you're not a soldier, then why do you have them? For sport? Again, I'm not saying anything new. I'm actually saying what most Americans are saying. But to act as if the left wants to put flowers in gun barrels is ludicrous, and actually more politicizing than actually asking for our lawmakers to do something. And stop with that buzzword, politicizing. Since when is wondering if we should ban a weapon political? If it's at all political, it's because the lobbying groups keep it from happening. It's not political to call for action. It's actually very American. And to not let the debate happen, and don't kid yourself, it's not going to happen, because of lawmakers getting campaign donations or being intimidated, that's another word, corruption. That's the textbook definition. Boom, there's your next column, John Cass. That and bump stocks, you can do that too. In a strange turn, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had to call a press conference to say he loves his job and he wants to keep it because it was leaked that Tillerson called the president a moron back in the summer after the Boy Scout speech. When asked directly about whether or not he called the president a moron, Tillerson said, hey, I really want to get into it, which probably means he did it. If I were like, did you call Pete Zimmerman a moron? Like, I don't really, I don't really want to get into that. But according to Trump, that means that he didn't call him that and that this is fake news and they're making stuff up again. Ring the dinner bell, folks. It's time to feast on the media. And more Washington hogwash, a Republican congressman from Pennsylvania is in hot water because text messages revealed that he suggested to his mistress that she get an abortion after a pregnancy scare. Okay, none of our business, right? Except Representative Murphy is one of the leading, if not the leading voice in Congress against abortions. What? You know what? I think it's time we check the list of jobs that Americans despise the most. Let me go ahead and get that list, see if it's changed. Here we go. I think I've got it.
Oh, down 7 spots to come in near the bottom. Politicians.
Then tax collectors, meter maids, and talk show hosts. I think it's in that order. In weather today, rainy. In sports, the Cubs announced that Kyle Hendricks will start game 1 against the Nationals. Lester's going to start game 2. Jose Quintana will go in game 3. That means Jake Arrieta won't pitch until game 4 of the series. Joe Maddon said that injuries have affected the rotation and they want to give as much rest as possible to Arrieta before he pitches. I will say this, as a Sox fan, man, I hope Quintana works out. I really do. At home, game 3, give us a good game, Jose. I know you have it in you because otherwise you're going to set Cubs-Sox relations back like 100 years. You're down 2-0 coming back from Washington in the second inning. It's already 5-0. They're going to be like, White Sox suck. White Sox suck. That'll be... The Cubs have had success on the road this year and, frankly, have been world beaters everywhere in the last couple months of the season. All eyes on the Dodgers and the Indians, but the Cubs have had an equally impressive run just under the radar. So they do come into the series with a hot hand where the Nats, they actually rested a lot of their guys down the stretch, including DL stints for Bryce Harper, Steven Strasburg, and Max Scherzer. Didn't realize, but the Nats are playing games with their rotation, too. Scherzer pulled a hammy on his last start. He may not be the Game 1 starter. They haven't announced yet. Ooh, the chess game commences. Tonight, the Rockies and Diamondbacks get at it in a wild card game. The Diamondbacks were good enough to win any division this year, but they play in the NL West against the Dodgers, so they're the wild card. Winner tonight will play the Dodgers next round. If the Diamondbacks can beat the Rockies, that's going to be an awesome series because the Diamondbacks have the Dodgers' number. Watch out. The Sox, well, we'll have plenty of time to talk about the Sox after the playoffs, right? Clean out those lockers. The Blackhawks start up tomorrow against the Penguins. The Hawks are picked up by many to get back to the top, although it won't be easy with the Preds, the Wild, and the Blues all ready to make another run. The big question will be whether or not the Hawks have fixed their defensive weaknesses and will address their penalty kill situation. But remember, the Hawks were number one. They were number one seed last year going into the playoffs. So hard to improve upon that without worrying about too much tinkering, right? Brian Bickell was back at the UC today for a press conference announcing his retirement. The Bulls, they won last night. They play again tonight. One of their guys got into a little bit of a pushing match with New Orleans star DeMarcus Cousins. So go guy that I've never heard of. Seriously, I saw it on SportsCenter. I've never seen that guy before. I have a feeling that's what this year is going to be like. Ooh, that guy. Although the Bulls did win, and they did win by playing Hoiberg ball, spreading the floor and shooting 34 three-pointers attempts. 34 attempts. This is why they brought in Hoiberg, right? They gave and then they gave him players who liked isolation, like Wade Butler and Rondo, who couldn't shoot for Bumpkus. So now maybe there's a method to the offseason madness. Young sharpshooters put up 120 points a game, maybe. Something there. That never works. The Bears are getting ready for their big Monday night football game. They play the Vikings. The Vikings. Who actually likes the Vikings? Does anybody? Even people in Minnesota, do they like the Vikings? Actually, it's been a while since I've even paid attention to who's on that team. I mean, Adrian Peterson's gone. I know that. Teddy Bridgewater's still hurt. But who plays for this Vikings team? Does Keith Millard still play defensive tackle? How about a Chris Dolman? He lined up on the left. Darren Nelson carrying the rock at the tailback position. Or how about their scrappy white middle linebacker, Scott Studwell? Is he still playing with blood all over his pants? Scott Studwell. And finally tonight, new census data is showing that not only is Chicago shrinking, but it's also becoming wealthier and more educated, making it the smartest big city in America. You don't say. If we're so smart, why do waiters keep explaining small plates to us? Have you ever been here before? Great. We do things a little different at this restaurant. It's a little different. That's the carryout for October 4th, 2017. Hey, we got two types of fries tonight. We got old and soggy or new and scalding hot. Your choice. They're both terrible. All right, Mike Fouché is coming up. We'll talk about Chicago's gun laws, but also about why there's a mass exodus out of the General Assembly. Mike Fouché joins us every Wednesday. He does right after the news. Here on the download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Things are going well. How about you?
I'm good. I had my my son's open house tonight.
Nice. How'd that go?
It's great until you get to the question part, and then it's just like it's everyone's got an individual personalized question about themselves and their kid.
I hear you.
And it's all about book reports.
Right, right.
They just asked the same question the person before. All right.
Now, do you get any of the homework done during class?
Exactly.
A little stressed at night. See, my husband does this talk show. Never around to help out.
I was the one who had to leave early. And I still wanted to be like, I'm so sorry to interrupt. Yeah. I'm on the air from 7 to 11 on WGN. Please check it out.
Like, well, if ever coming up here in the next week or two, whenever our open houses / parent-teacher conferences are, you'll hear the vibrating of my phone, the frantic messages from Mrs. Right.
Hey, call me back. I was just at the thing. You can't believe what they said.
I can't believe what they told us about book reports.
I can't believe it.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Mike Fouché is in the building.
Good to see
you. Mike Fouché from the Daily Line joins us every Wednesday to talk
politics.
Barely made it. You did.
Lakeshore Drive traffic, man.
There you go. You know, but you planned ahead. You made it. So
I
that's
did.
All that matters. It doesn't even matter. You're here.
Boy Scout.
All right. So let's talk about, of course, you know, everyone paying attention this week to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And the local politicians, both Governor Rauner and Mayor Emanuel, both spoke on it. Governor Rauner surprisingly saying that he's open to a dialogue about what should come of this when it comes to the safety of citizens. Mayor Emanuel, not surprising, taking on the president, saying that gun laws and something needs to change. A lot of politics. But one of the things that was surprising was to hear Sarah Huckabee Sanders kind of throw Chicago under the bus at the beginning, saying we're not going to talk. It's not the time for talking about gun laws. But
right,
if you really want to talk gun laws, Chicago's got terrible ones, and look at their.
I think she's got
ones.
A dartboard in her office. Like, you know, what's the thing I should go for in case people ask me a question I don't want? And one of them is dump on Chicago.
So. And it's really, there's been a couple of pieces that have come out since, really kind of pushing back on this political statement that Chicago has the strictest gun laws. They always just ... But not really.
No, it's not. I mean, you know, there was a lot of news, I think it was maybe 10 years or so ago, when Chicago had a law banning handguns. But that was found... It was, on a shaky legal ground to begin with, that the city could pass its own laws about handguns, and that was swept away by the Supreme Court. And the truth is that Illinois' gun laws are really what sets it for Chicago. You know, Illinois has a concealed carry law. It's still relatively easy to get a gun. You can carry, you know, all the same guns you can carry in the rest of the state, which is pretty much all of them, except in, you know, you can't. There aren't gun stores in Chicago, but, you know, really, what does that matter? Particularly when you can go to Indiana and purchase a lot of guns with, you know, very little... Much less regulation.
And that goes for all the bordering states, really, when you talk about the Midwest.
Yeah, although Indiana has some of the most lenient laws about gun purchasing. And, you know, continually the police are constantly saying, look, you know, when we track where a lot of these guns come from gun crimes in Chicago's roughest neighborhoods, most of them track back to places in Indiana. So there is a lot of cases of stories about gang members going to Indiana, buying a bunch of guns, and then coming back to Chicago and distributing them. So, you know, that's not an uncommon story, and the police department will talk about that all day.
You know, it is interesting. Does the state of Illinois, could the state get into this debate when it comes to whether or not to ban bump stocks or to get into semi-automatic, automatic rifles and all the things that go into that? Is that something that a Democrat Senate and Democrat House in the state could take up as a measure if the federal government's not going to?
I think that you're going to find that this is not necessarily just party in Illinois. Most downstate Democrats are going to have a lot of trouble with a lot of gun regulation and gun laws. We could talk about all the different creative things that you could do. You know, you could have a law that says that there has to be a microprint on a casing so that you could trace where the casing came from. You could have a law that required a special sensor that could decide that could figure out who the holder of the gun is so that it's tracked just to an individual hand. You could have a law that requires certain safeties to be put on the gun. There's a lot of things that you could do, but, you know, I think that there's been a general resistance to all of these sort of things from the National Rifle Association and from gun advocates.
Well, we'll definitely be tracking this story because it will continue to be one not just at the national level but the state level. Let's talk about the Chicago Police Department. Kind of a rocky week for them. First, the Inspector General comes out and says the way that the police have been using overtime has been mismanaged. They've burned through the money, and this is a problem. And then lawsuits, and one today or yesterday that was that I'm confused by, and I want to get clarification on that. It's really about how the police treat disabled, but it's really about the consent decree.
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time with understanding.
Let's talk about the lawsuit first. That was brought up by the American Civil Liberties Union. And what they are claiming is that disabled are having multiple problems and their treatment. There's a pattern and practice of the police department of how disabled people are being treated, particularly when they're being arrested, and that police aren't prepared and trained in order to deal with disabled. So deaf people, when they're arrested, maybe they're acting, they're resisting in a certain way. They can't be notified. You know, you need to stop doing this. People in wheelchairs have not been treated correctly. You know, they've been bullied and moved around and hurt. in the process of an arrest or those sort of things. But really what this is, ACLU has been mulling over for some time, suing the city of Chicago and the police department about the consent decree, which is the same thing. There was a case that was brought a number of months ago led by the Black Lives Matter movement. And then another case that was brought up last month by Attorney General Lisa Madigan. So those two cases already existed.
Essentially saying, trying to force the city of Chicago, the police department, into this federal consent decree that they were going to, and everyone agreed they were going to enter, and then everyone's pulled back.
The mayor has pulled back, yeah. Yes, which would provide federal oversight and force the city to hit a series of milestones in terms of reforming the police department.
Is that the only way that something like this could happen, would be lawsuits? Is there a track record for that kind of thing working?
There's no track record in the city of Chicago for police reform. There's no solid track record. And there are lots and lots of people that have said so. Mayor Emanuel has resisted that. He said, no, no, no. But I don't think that anybody who has been involved in police reform really agrees with him on that.
Yeah.
The American Civil Liberties Union has been thinking about entering in some sort of case, and they've held back. And I think that one of the things that I've heard from them long before all this was going on is that they're very concerned about how much community engagement there is in the reform process. And if you look at the BLM case, they want to have community engagement, but they don't really have a very strong case. They don't have a lot of good standing. If you look at the case with the Attorney General, the Attorney General has very good standing, but the Attorney General has made it very clear that she's not really looking to put in a community engagement piece into whatever the consent decree is. So I think ACLU, they're very interested in having a community oversight board and having community members that are actively engaged in overseeing the police department for a long period of time, and I think that's why they're getting into this now.
All right, let's do this. Let's take a break because I want to come back and we'll pick back up with the overtime story this
yeah.
week. This is one that we've kind of talked about yeah. The mayor and the city sort of, not, I don't want to say fudging is the wrong word, but moving money around and using a lot of overtime.
No, not moving it around, just running the clock. And then
the
saying next yeah. year you got to pay in. You
yeah,
know,
so we'll talk yeah. about that. Mike Fouché from the Daily Line in studio tonight, as he is every Wednesday. Stay with us. Mike Fouché in studio from the Daily Line, as he is every Wednesday night, to talk local politics. All right, so let's talk about this overtime story. On the surface, you're like, okay, so they blew through their overtime budget in the Chicago Police Department. Not that surprising.
Which was $50 million.
That's more surprising. That's where I was going. I mean, maybe the numbers will tell that obviously how much they went through tells a bigger picture. And I guess the big ticket question that I have for me, and I'm sure listeners as well, is this more indicative of just fuzzy math, meaning there's not enough police officers, so we'll just pay them overtime. And the mayor is kind of moving, playing a shell game with how many police officers are actually needed to police the city of Chicago.
So let's talk about numbers. In 2011, when Rahm Emanuel first became mayor, the police department, I think, spent $16 million on overtime. Last year, they spent a little over $50 million on overtime. This year, they're on track to get to like $150 million.
Whoa.
So, I mean, there's two pieces that are going on here. Yesterday, what got a lot of attention was the Inspector General's report that there is abuse of the overtime system. And there probably is some of that, but the real thing that's going on is that when you go talk to people in the police department, the commanders are telling all the people down the line, use as much overtime as you want. Go for it. Overtime, overtime, overtime for you, overtime for you, overtime for everybody. And, the question is, well, why is this the strategy? I mean, we've been talking a lot about why we need more police officers. There need to be more cops on the beat. Why are they just giving away all this overtime?
Right, right.
Well, it turns out that there's a few things that are going on here. First, serving police officers love extra overtime. I mean, there are stories of police officers that are making over $200,000 a year because they're serving much overtime.
It's a great way to get extra income. Yeah.
Yeah. Pay off your house in a couple of years. It's great. There are stories. The other thing is that when you have police officers that are serving overtime, You don't have to hire another cop. That means less pensions. You have cops that are serving overtime. It's
interesting.
It's cheaper because when you have a police officer, a full police officer working a full day, you got to pay for the pension of that person. When you have a police officer that's working a day or 2 days or a day and a half, you're still only paying one police officer.
So,
pension.
I mean, as much as it's alarming for us to see that number and as taxpayers to say, whoa, that's amazing how much overtime. It may not in the long run, when you think about the bigger picture, just be a better strategy when it comes to how you pull. I mean, but the only problem is that, you know, when you start talking about overtime, you talk about you work your shift and this is on top of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it's standard the way that I think of overtime, that someone worked their 8-hour day and now they're working 4 more hours.
Right.
Or working on a Sunday. I mean, is there any fatigue issues and things like that
you
got to worry about?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are lots of stories about cops that are taking naps, you know, on the street, you know, sitting in their cars. Well, I've actually seen guys sitting on the street taking a nap down the street from a police station. I mean, you know, it's not to say the police officers are being lazy. I think that they're all redlining it at this point. I mean, you talk to plenty of police officers and they all say, yeah, everybody's, you know, really pushing it to the limit. So there's another advantage, which is that when police officers are doing overtime rather than hiring another police officer, you're keeping your headcount down. That means that you have less risk. You don't have to worry about laying people off. You don't have to worry about, you know, so that's definitely a strategy. And then finally, you know, Rahm Emanuel has got a real problem on the Southwest and the Northwest sides, which is that he's not necessarily very popular in those communities, which also, by the way, have lots and lots of police officers. And so if you have lots and lots of police officers that are happy with all the overtime that they're getting and they're getting a good deal,
why would you go in there and,
you know,
mess with it?
Why get rid of the mayor? And then they're going to be starting negotiations on the police contract. So if you have all these police officers that are fat and happy with all the overtime they've been getting, hey, you know,
well, that money's
got to
come from
easier
somewhere. But I like the idea that it balances out more pensions. But I do still think that you need more police officers. We only got 2 minutes here. Quick. We'll talk about this a lot coming up here as well. But the 29th member of the General Assembly in Springfield
David Harris
says, I'm out. I don't want reelection. I don't want to be a part of Springfield.
Yeah.
This is alarming. 29 different legislators. Probably
a
good thing.
And we're probably not done yet.
And it might be a good thing just in the way that, hey, we want to see turnover, especially from all the gridlock. But a huge number of lawmakers that are leaving Springfield after what's happened.
A lot of them are
the
good ones. A lot of them are the good ones. You know, these aren't dead weight that are necessarily leaving. And it's a lot of Republicans that are leaving who are just really sick and tired of dealing with Bruce Rauner as basically their boss and overlord.
So more Republicans than Democrats.
More Republicans than Democrats. I think it's, you know, 3-2, 3-1 ratio. And Democrats that are leaving, you know, I think they're frustrated with how they got to toe the line for Madigan. I think this leadership battle is really taking a toll.
Does it signal that it's going to be much, much more competitive in the 2018 election when it comes to the parties vying for these open seats?
I think the primaries are going to be crazy, and for sure, you know, we'll see what happens in the general elections.
Well, we'll keep our eye on it. Mike Fouché, of course, The Daily Line, joins us every Wednesday. You can find it at thedailyline.net. Mike, great to see you. Thanks
great
for coming
to be here.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new movie, The Florida Project, is hitting theaters this weekend. The film premiered at the Cannes Film Festival and will be shown in select theaters around Chicagoland starting on Friday. The Florida Project is a film that focuses on childhood and the struggle to get by at an Orlando motel on the outskirts of Disney World called the Magic Castle. It's a motel that serves as an extended stay for families that are living hand-to-mouth in extreme poverty. The hotel manager, Bobby, played by Willem Dafoe, serves as the heavy, but also the protector and makeshift parent for a group of largely unsupervised kids that have run of the place. The movie is visually stunning, capturing life on the fringes of a theme park, and it's also a story about a forgotten class of people living on the fringes trying to provide a life for their families. The movie is written and directed by Sean Baker. Baker is an award-winning filmmaker who brought us Tangerine, 2015 film that was shot entirely on an iPhone, and he was the man behind the Fox cult classic Greg the Bunny. The Florida Project's getting great reviews, and it's my pleasure to welcome Sean Baker to the big table tonight. Sean, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful film. You know, it's one of these films that stays with you. When I saw it, I walked out and I said, that was depressing. But at the same time, it continues to stay with me. Mm. Why tell this story? What drew you to telling the story about families on the outskirts staying in motels outside of Disney World?
Well, the topic was brought to me by my co-screenwriter, Chris Bergosh. He is first off in love with Disney. His mother lives down in the Kissimmee area, which is right next to Orlando. He brought me this topic. There were several news stories written about the fact that there was a hidden homeless population right outside of the parks in the budget motels that line Route 192. When I refer to the hidden homeless, I mean I'm talking about essentially homeless families and individuals, some having children, who are living week to week, sometimes night to night, at budget motels that were once tourist motels. Now they're sort of basically welfare motels, right in the heart of the tourist capital of the world.
It's so stark to be able to see the architecture and the buildings around it that are all serving the purpose of trying to get tourists to stop and buy T-shirts or buy different things, but knowing that that's the backdrop for people's lives, for what we see in these budget motels.
Yeah, these were once motels that were targeted towards tourists. So they actually, in a way, ripped off the themes of the parks. You know, the bright colors themed in a way that almost could be from one of those Disney films, a Magic Castle, a Gator Motel. And, you know, we knew that this would provide just a tremendous amount of eye candy, too, because it's so unique to this area. I should point out, though, that this is a nationwide problem. This is a nationwide issue. Yeah. I think the journalists focused on it, just as we do with this film, focus out in this area just because of the very sad and real juxtaposition of homeless children living out right outside the place that we consider a place designed for children and meant for children and the most magical place on earth for children. So, but it is something that is a nationwide issue, and I discovered this upon doing research. I quite honestly did not know the term hidden homeless. I didn't know there was a hidden homeless population. I've lived in New York. I've lived in L.A. I've seen homeless on the street, though there is a population that's basically barely holding on to a roof over their head, one step away from being on the streets.
And I would assume, you know, in that research comes a better understanding of, because you're a filmmaker. I mean, at the end of the day, this isn't a documentary. It's not a journalism project. But how much do you need to know about the subject and the area to get it right, to be authentic, to deliver the real in this fictional tale?
For me and Chris, we will not move forward unless we are comfortable writing about this world that we are not a part of. So it takes time, and it takes immersion, it takes collaboration, and it takes knowing the details, you know, those little details. And sometimes it's slang, and sometimes it's the procedural, meaning, you know, there's elements of this film that focuses on child services and child welfare services. And so we had to understand that. We had to understand how the welfare system worked in Central Florida and bringing those details to the screen. The one thing I want audiences to know is that, you know, with all of this, it's not probably the way we've painted it so far is that it's a very heavy-handed, very depressing film. But but this was also very much inspired by The Little Rascals, quite honestly. I've always wanted to make
I was going to ask you about that, because the children in the movie, you know, they live in this environment, this hidden homeless population we're talking about, and their parents are struggling with real adult issues and trying to get by. But you do a tremendous job of painting this. They are their children, and they are living a childhood. They find ways in this environment, in this landscape, to do exactly what children do. Whether if you're skipping rocks, if you live in an area with a lake, you skip rocks in a lake. If you live in a abandoned a hotel, you skip rocks against the door.
Exactly.
Or spit on cars.
it's basically the grounds of these motels are these kids' backyards, and so. The unfortunate fact is that a lot of these children don't have the means to go to the parks that are right there and teased in their face. So what we wanted to do is show, is have one character, the character of Mooney, who is the lead of this film, a little six-year-old girl, who basically, because of her age and because of her innocence and still having that sense of wonder and imagination, she makes the most of it. She made, without really being conscious of it, she's right, making lemonade, you know. So we wanted to show how children will always, you know, make the most of their situation.
And you do that because it's her and she's got some friends that are from both the hotel that she's staying at, the motel and the place across the way, because they're all kind of connected.
Yes.
But talk about that, because the amazing part about the film to me is that childhood is happening in these circumstances. Mm. And it shines through. The kids and the little girl is amazing, tremendous, and I want to talk about that later. But talk about how important it was for you to really honor that juxtaposition, because you talked about the juxtaposition of Disney World versus what we see here.
Yes.
But the juxtaposition against the gritty part of adult life,
right,
and childhood.
Well, I mentioned the Little Rascals before. And if you think about what the Little Rascals were, they were these comic shorts focused on the comical adventures of little children. But it was set against the Great Depression. These were kids living in poverty. But it never focused on that part of it. It was first and foremost, it was kids being kids. And I think adults watching those comic shorts, they take a lot more away from it, because there is that message there. The issue is there. It's just that the audience wasn't hit over the head with
right.
it. Now, that's what I wanted to do with this film. I wanted to... It really stems back to the film I made prior to this one called Tangerine, the film you mentioned that was shot on the iPhone. We were dealing with some serious subject matter there. Our two protagonists were trans women of color who had to resort to sex work in order to survive. So that was also an issue film, a political film. But we presented it to the audience in a package of a comedy. And it stemmed from our taking time in that community and getting to know the women in that community and understanding that humor was what they used to cope, to get by. And humor was such a part of their lives. When we would hang out with them, we were doing our research and taking notes. We always felt that we were going to a stand-up comedy night. We were laughing for hours. Then we would go home and realize, why were we laughing?
Right.
We just heard the most tragic stories. This is horrible. So it was important for Chris and I to not only focus on behavioral comedy, but to somehow incorporate a comic style to these stories. And we saw that it was a risk and very dangerous in a way, because especially, you know, we're two cisgender white guys who from outside of that world, and we had to be very respectful and make sure representation was correct. But what happened was that it hit audiences, and I think because it was easily digestible through comedy, it had an impact. And to this day, I'm still getting messages on Facebook and Twitter by strangers and saying that, you know, I never knew that I would connect with the characters of Alexandra and Cindy, but because I never thought I would be wanting to hang out with sex workers on the corner of Santa Monica and Highland, but I do now, and I love these girls.
Isn't that filmmaking? Yeah. It's about connection for us to be able to relate.
Right.
Sean Baker's my guest. His film, The Florida Project, is out in theaters this weekend. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back.
Sure.
Sean Baker, because I have so many more questions about filmmaking connections and other aspects of this film. The Florida Project in theaters now. Sean Baker, my guest. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Sean Baker, my guest tonight at the big table, the award-winning filmmaker, and his new film, The Florida Project, hits theaters this weekend. A great film starring William Dafoe, who's just amazing in this film, and we'll talk about him as well. Piggyback on what we were talking about before the break, this idea of connection and relating to characters. Another thread from Tangerine to The Florida Project is the way that you use desperation. Desperation plays a big role in The Florida Project, about being this close to being out on the street, to be staying in these budget motels and can only stay for a certain amount of time, and you have to come up with a weekly rent. A single mother living with her daughter while her daughter, like we said, almost lives a little rascal life and runs around. Mm. She is in a desperate way.
Yes.
Talk about how important that is for filmmaking to really be able to tap into desperation.
Well, you know, I've been interested in the underground economy. I've been focusing on it for several films now, and the position that people will find themselves in where they have to resort to it. And I'm a dramatist. I bringing these stories to an audience, you know, there's obviously it's obviously part of the drama. It's a way of, you know, keeping the audience engaged. But these are real struggles, and these are real, and it's not just to keep an audience engaged. It's to shine a light on what actual, you know, people are going through in this day and age. And I think that, you know, for me, you know, I mentioned before, I've never heard the term hidden homeless before this situation, before getting into this making of this film. And I feel that most people don't know about it. And these are issues that I think are real. If you care about your fellow man in any way, shape, or form, we don't want to see anybody desperate. And I think that, you know, stories like this getting out there and people and you know, seeing the universal thread amongst people, I think that it's just one step towards
helping. Well, there's so, I mean, I see it in several different characters, and obviously the character of Haley, the mother, desperate to keep a roof over her head. But you also see desperation a bit in William Defoe's character, Bobby, in the way that he wants to make sure he wants to protect the people that live there, but he also wants to – he needs this to be a place that, that he maintains order.
Yeah, we took time to meet people from this community, and that means that we were meeting residents, we were meeting managers from motels, owners from motels. And when we met certain managers from motels, we saw there was a common thread. There was a in a way, desperation, but and also it was a they were stuck in a very difficult place. This is not what they signed up for.
The rules are you stay for one night, you got to go.
But, one of many rules,
but they have to be lax because these are difficult, very precarious situations.
And these are men who have their own families, and they are holding on to a job. They have to keep it professional. They have to manage this small business with very little help because probably most of these motels don't have a budget to have personnel. So he's doing everything, and yet there's at the same time there's a compassion because he knows. That he may be forced to evict one of these families. He's in that position. So there was what I noticed is that there was almost a reluctant parental guidance there because they don't want to get too close because of the fact that, you know, they're keeping that distance out of the sake of just not being hurt themselves. But this is something that we saw in many of the motel managers, and it inspired this Bobby character.
And the Bobby character, there's just pure emotion in the way that, you're right, he does play the parental role because he's a hotel manager, and a lot of the families are broken families or unsupervised, a lot of supermothers, unsupervised kids that are just running around. So there is this need for order.
Well, using the grounds of the motel as their backdrop and sometimes being overseen by older siblings, et cetera. But
the idea being that they're running independent throughout the day.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There, you can see the struggle, the emotional struggle that this character has, because you're absolutely right. And he plays it so well, and in the direction you can feel that he almost has to stop himself short because he knows the danger these kids are in. He knows the desperation of the situation, and yet he knows he can't get too close.
Exactly. And Willem understood this, and he came into town 1 week early, met with some of the motel managers, really just, I think, absorbed them, became the Florida man that we wanted him to become by the time we were shooting. And it was interesting because at any point, you know, and I encourage improvisation, we always know where the scene will go, but within the scene, I allow my actors to be loose. And at no point did Willem actually... there was no sappy moments. He didn't ever bend over and hug the children in a sappy way, melodramatic way, because he knew that his character might want to, but just never go there. And it was very interesting to see Willem do this.
You've had a tremendous, and I want to talk about this more, but you've had a tremendous career with your projects working with unknown actors.
Yeah.
And even in this movie, some of the actors, this is their first time to kids as well.
Yes.
Willem Dafoe, of course, is probably one of the most known actors in our time. How did that relationship work for you in working with someone who definitely knows the craft?
Well, my fear was that a recognizable face would take the audience out of it immediately. I mean, I need the suspension of disbelief to kick in right away with this movie because I want the audience to feel like they're spending the summer at this motel and believe every moment of it. So But we, of course, because of the budget of this movie and the fact that we want this movie out there, you have to cast it with at least one recognizable face and one box office draw. Now, Willem's name came across the table. And he was one of those few names where I thought, oh, yeah, no, of course. He's such an amazing actor. He can transform. And he is transformative. Yeah. And for me, within even like 3 seconds of seeing him on screen, he's already blended in. He is that Bobby character. And it just comes because of his skill. And yeah.
Do you approach directing an actor of someone?
Oh, directing
it.
Do
you approach it differently than you do someone who's yes. maybe new to the game?
Yes. Yes, you do. And it always helps me out when somebody like Willem, in this case, Willem comes and is so patient, is so kind, and is so giving, and understands that he's working with a lot of first-timers, never loses patience, and actually helps them in many ways. Yeah. Because it's so easy, to be intimidated. Think about Bria Venate, who plays Haley in this movie, who I basically cast off of Instagram. She was so green. She had a crash course in acting for about a month before the shoot, and had to hold her own with a 2-time Academy Award nominee, and she did it. It was because, number one, she's skilled and she's great, and I'm so proud of her. But at the same time, also because Willem is such a gentle soul, and he's the type that would never put the pressure on, and she never felt intimidated with him. She may have felt intimidated by our cameras and our crew, but never with him. Yeah.
Sean Baker, my guest. His film, The Florida Project, hits theaters this weekend, starring Willem Dafoe and others. Okay, we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation with Sean Baker about the movie The Florida Project. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The new film, The Florida Project, is out this weekend. We're talking about it with the co-screenwriter and the director, Sean Baker, who is in studio tonight. I really enjoyed the film. I really did. And I'm enjoying the conversation as well. It is interesting because one of the things I took away was how realistic the portrayal was for not just Willem Dafoe, not just for the main characters, but for the kids. They don't feel like they're acting. It's almost like the direction is go be a kid. Talk about the challenge and also what you're trying to get out when you're working with kids that are portraying 6-year-olds.
Sure. To tell you the truth, I was naive going into it. I had worked with toddlers in the past. I had never worked with kids of that age, 6 to 8. And I thought it was going to be that easy. Be a kid. But it's not. It's not. Especially when you're dealing with big 35mm cameras and a crew and a union crew. You have to be more structured. So we brought on an acting coach. Thank God we did. Because I was just assuming I would be able to, if anything went wrong, I would be able to manipulate their performance in editing. I'm my own editor. So I thought if I get enough coverage, I can make them look good. But I didn't have to, which was awesome. Not only because, we have these incredible little actors who actually are incredibly skilled, but my acting coach, Samantha Kwan, she came on board early. She worked with these kids as soon as we cast them and as soon as they got off of school. We shot over the summer, last summer. So their last day of school, I think the next day they were on our set. And we treated the summer like their summer camp because basically we were taking their summer away from them. And so we wanted them to have fun. We wanted them to learn.
And it was a summer story as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. Right. And you have Christopher Rivera, who plays Scooty, Valeria Cotto, who plays Jancy, and of course, Brooklyn Prince playing Mooney. And these three were like three extroverts. Yeah. Well, first of all, there's a lot going on here, but I think we cast right. We cast three extroverted kids who had fun and weren't really, I don't think they had a lot of, their inhibitions were already gone.
Yeah.
Let's just say that. They weren't ever embarrassed or careful about trying things. But I did learn the hard way. You just can't ask a 6-year-old to improvise. No, it has to be based on something. They have to at least have learned their scripted lines first, and they have to understand blocking. And blocking is very different when you're working with kids. It's not, if you're speaking to an adult, you're saying, I want you to walk from the left side of the room to the right side of the room and then spin and address this person. With a little kid, you have to say, watch me. I'm walking here. 1, 2, 3. And you literally have to walk through the motions with them physically and show them. But these kids were so awesome that they picked it up fast. They were having fun. They understood their characters. And then when I did have extra time, I would ask for them to, like, put it into your own words. Let's improvise a bit, because I knew I had already covered myself by getting their scripted stuff. Mm-hmm. And now everything else was just gravy. And I have to tell you, these kids were wonderful at it. They were just having fun. Yeah. They were just
shows both the acting and the improvisation, because what Brooklyn specifically is able to capture is what you need for the film, which is this innocence. The world around her is corrupt. Her mother, the severe situation that they're in, having to sell perfume in front of the resorts, the impact of being just a couple miles from Disney World and living how they are. But she needs to be able to keep that innocence, and she does, and the kids do in such a way that it tugs at it. I don't want to say heartstrings, but it makes an emotional impact on the viewer, because you recognize that when they say, you know, childhood is innocence, that this is what they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she is, in actuality, Brooklyn was 6 when we shot. I mean, so she had that about her. But she was also, what's amazing about Brooklyn Prince is that she's like an old soul too, and she's wise beyond her years. And I honestly put her in the same camp as like Jodie Foster and the Fannings, because I feel that she has a lifelong career ahead of her. She's one of those born thespians. She understood method. She had her own method. And it was really incredible to see her work, because there's a bit very without giving any spoilers away, there's a very dramatic scene at the end of the movie in which she has to produce tears. Yeah. And to watch her do that is an incredible thing. We knew she was going to attempt it. We didn't rehearse it. And in that moment, when we were running the camera, I think her little co-star tried to start some small talk with her. Just being in that moment, they're bored. And so little Valeria said, "Oh, what are we going to do this weekend?" They became friends on set. And little Brooklyn goes, "Valeria, I can't talk right now. I'm getting ready to cry, and I have to go to another place," or something like that. And she was getting into this mindset. And I watched this little girl go through the actions of like a seasoned actor, and it was an incredible thing.
You know, another big character in this film is Florida.
Yes, it is. Yes.
You know, when you talk about the life of right on the outskirts of theme parks, especially Disney World, there's a lot that goes into that. Florida gets a bad rap. Florida becomes stereotypical. People talk about it, but you really have to be able to thread that line of this is, you know, there's a lot in media about Floridians.
Right.
But this has to be somewhat of an empathetic storyline.
Yeah.
Even though these aren't the most, they're human characters, but they're not the most positive. They're not the most redeeming, if you will, in some cases.
In some cases. Yeah. We never wanted to poke fun. We never wanted to laugh at. That was something that's just disrespectful. Yeah, as you said, Florida does get a bad rap. But if you live there a while, you actually do fall in love with it. And what I found is that, you know, there's a strong sense of community there. There are many people are trying to eradicate the homeless situation that's going on. You have philanthropists, you have working with the agencies there and the local government, and even Disney, who gave $500,000 to the Homeless Impact Fund last year. There's a community there and they're trying. And why would I walk in there as a filmmaker and just make fun and make a farce out of the whole thing?
Right.
I wasn't going to do that. So, but I also have to say there is a lot of humor in the film. There is a lot of humor, and you could almost call the film a comedy. But that humor comes from, I think, just behavioral comedy and watching kids be kids and interactions, funny interactions.
The architecture of that area is amazing. I mean, some of those places that are built to, like I said, attract tourism are things that are unique to that strip.
Very unique.
You're not going to see them anywhere
else in the world. Yeah. No, you have basically all these small businesses trying to grab the attention of tourists driving through on their way to the park. So gift shops will have a very unique. There's one gift shop that we shot in the film, which has this giant Merlin type character overlooking the parking lot. You have these beautiful ice cream shops in which they are basically ice cream cone structures. I mean, they're really colorful and very, very interesting, you know, architecture. And that's a filmmaker's dream. I mean, I'm basically given production value. And also, it does have a real sense of place, it's bringing you to another world.
Right.
And you always want to do that with a film. You want to bring the audience to a world they haven't been to before. And a lot of people have been to this world. It's just that they haven't seen this part.
Right,
it is the tourist capital of the world. So right. A ton of people have been there. But I don't think a lot of people know about
the only time you stop most of the time is for a stoplight.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Sean Baker, my guest tonight, his movie The Florida Project hitting theaters this week in select theaters around Chicagoland. You mentioned Tangerine, the film you did solely on the iPhone, and now you do this movie, both really kind of exploring the underground economy. Do you see yourself as you move forward now that this movie, shot this movie last year, you've already done the Cannes Film Festival, this movie's coming out. For the projects coming up, do you find yourself gravitating towards those stories, those undertold stories about the underground, doing the same things you've done with the last two films?
Perhaps. I'm going to be sort of waiting for inspiration and looking to what topics interest me. I was very inspired this year by a film like Get Out, because I feel as if that was a perfect combination of entertainment, and yet it did tackle serious issues of race relations, and the way he delivered it to an audience was in a genre form. It was a horror comedy, and that's why it did so well. And I think that that's what's exciting me most about current cinema, the way that we're able to, you know, as filmmakers and having this platform, be able to shine light on certain issues, but remembering and keeping in mind that cinema is probably first and foremost an entertainment medium, and you have to keep the audience
in mind. Do you have to keep
mind.
That in mind as someone who falls in love with these stories?
You have to, because you want it to get out there. I mean, look, I adore documentaries, and I watch documentaries all the time, and I'm very inspired by documentaries, but I'm a dramatist, so I don't know how to do that. I know how to do this, and this is how I feel as if I can shine light on these issues.
Sean Baker, the film The Florida Project, out this weekend in select theaters around Chicagoland, the film getting great reviews. Sean Baker is the co-writer and the director of the film. Sean, thanks so much for coming by and spending some time at the big table. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I highly recommend The Florida Project. It's depressing. You know, it's one of those movies where, you know, at this day and age, you know, especially this week, you're looking for an uplifting movie. This might not be the one. But I have also been reading that this movie is getting great reviews. And Pete, you said that you read that the Brooklyn, the little girl, they're even talking about award season for her. I would not be surprised. There's always one kid they put into the Oscar mix. She's worth it because it blew my mind. I was like, there's not a hint of acting to her. She just played sort of a precocious, snot-nosed 6-year-old, 7-year-old. Talk back, everything about it was, so I really liked about the dialogue. She was really good at talking as if a 6-year-old talks, because she is one. Anyway, good movie, and go check it out, The Florida Project. We'll be hearing a lot more about that as it comes out this weekend. This weekend as well is the Chicago Podcast Festival. Be a part of the studio audience at the live taping of 3 WGN radio podcasts as part of the Chicago Podcast Festival this Saturday, October 7th at 7 p.m. The Old Town School of Folk Music. The lineup includes Nick DiGiulio Show, John Williams, and the Mincing Rascals. And Second City Works getting to Yes And, hosted by Kelly Leonard. It's a mix of entertainment, politics, and current events and business and creativity. Tickets, $25. Get details and a link to buy tickets at WGNradio.com/events. It's this Saturday, October 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Town School of Folk Music, 4545 North Lincoln Avenue in Chicago. Tickets and details at WGNradio.com/events. That'll be a good event. Yeah. A lot of good events going on. The marathon this weekend. You've got the Cubs as well, starting the NLDS. Right now, the Arizona Diamondbacks are winning in the fourth inning in a slugfest, 6-4. Classic wild card here, where it's just like, oh, we're gonna place this game's gonna take 6 hours. This is when you get to the playoffs in baseball. It's the only downside. Like, they don't really do it in football. I mean, I guess football slows down a little bit too. Basketball does, because they just take timeouts every 30 seconds, you know, just in the last 2 minutes of the game. But in baseball, doesn't it feel like because of the broadcast, they got to get a close-up shot of the pitcher, a close-up shot of the batter, and a close-up shot back to the pitcher. Then he steps off the mound. They do it. I mean, the intensity of a broadcast for a baseball game is a little – I mean, it adds 30 minutes to the game.
Mm-hmm.
If not more.
Plus you get you know, all the promos for all the new TBS shows coming out.
That's right. That's true. That'll be the fun part. I don't know. It just seems like they found a way to – I can understand why they – did they use the same rules? You know, this sort of 25-second countdown
for
the playoffs? Yeah,
2 minutes. I don't know. They must.
They have to, right? It's part of the game. It would be awesome if they didn't and every pitch took – you know, because the hitter has to step out of the batter's box and then touch every part of his body and readjust his mm-hmm. batting glove in some superstitious Nomar Garciaparra way.
Oh, yeah.
Every time he bats. And be like, that's actually a mental disorder, not as much as what a kitschy thing. That's such a great thing that he's so superstitious. I'm like, nah, or he's got OCD.
I would love to see how Nomar Garciaparra's plates are stacked in his kitchen.
Oh, man.
Probably exactly. Impeccable. All facing the same way. Each pattern the same way.
Next time we get a baseball player on, that's going to be a question I'm going to ask. You know, when you step out of the batter's box, and it's everyone now. I mean, it doesn't matter who it is. There is not one baseball player who steps out after a pitch and just sits there. Like, they have some routine where they hit the bat against their cleats, and then they have to hit the mm-hmm. knees, and then they have to adjust the belt, and then they got to go to the shoulders, and then they have to, you know, take a swing. Where that comes from.
Yeah, and where they develop that?
Yeah, where they develop it, and if it at all holds over to their personal life. Like you said, with Nomar's plates.
I still get angry at when I go to the Cubs game and I see people in Garciaparra Cubs jerseys. I'm like, come on, let's get a new, let's, come on. They won the World Series. You know, shell out for a Brian, you know, t-shirt.
No way, I would keep that. I'd keep Nomar. That was the shortest lived celebrity that ever played for the Cubs.
I still remember the day they got him and I was so excited.
Everyone was so excited. Nomar is up. I think it was at the game. He came up and it was like, strikeout. Like, it was just like it was, but that was a big deal. It was like the Cubs were gonna make a move. They had Noma.
Yep,
we might get some screen time on ESPN. We have Noma. All right, coming up, we'll talk about what you would preserve if you had the opportunity, and we'll also talk with Rich Cohen about the Cubs. Great book he's got out. Rich Cohen now becoming a regular on the show. New book about the Cubs and about growing up as a fan and what to do now that they're no longer the lovable losers. Instead, World Series champs. That's coming up. Thanks, Rob. You're listening to The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Rich Cohn's going to join us to talk about what it means to be a Cubs fan now that they're no longer the lovable losers. Defending world champions, they begin their playoff the hunt coming up here on Friday. So for a lifelong Cubs fan who identifies with the brand of being a lovable loser and how that's affected his life, how does it change his life now that they're no longer that? And for generations that are watching the Cubs for the first time. Rich Cohen, my guest, coming up here after the 9:30 news. Well, a new project at the Chicago Design Museum is asking a pretty simple yet important question. What's worth preserving? Now, you would expect that question from the Chicago Design Museum because preservation is usually a word that's thrown around when we talk about landmark architecture, historic buildings, design. But this project, created by founder and executive director Tanner Woodford, goes well beyond the built space. Tanner sent handwritten letters to friends and colleagues with a simple question, and what he got back was much more broad. What's worth preserving? Some say fountain pens. Some say plums. Some say true love. It's a great project that wants to be a book that features these handwritten responses from people like Jane Goodall and writer Elizabeth Crane and many, many others. Tanner Woodford's in studio tonight with me to talk about the project and to read some of the responses. Tanner, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I'm thrilled
to
be
here. So where does this come from? What a great concept to almost make it esoteric. What's worth preserving? Where does this idea come from?
Deep inside, first off. It is a really wonderful question, and it's one that took me a long time to get there, to be honest. And for me, preservation is really sort of at the core of the human experience. It's incredibly important to sort of look back the things that you want to save, look back at the things you want to communicate to your kids and your grandkids, and to be able to sort of to be able to answer this question says something about what you think about the future as well. So it's just broad enough that you can really look at it from multiple perspectives. Or you can be a realist about it. And we've gotten a broad range of answers.
And we've heard, I mean, preservation has always played out in the public space when it comes to architecture or buildings, even here in Michigan Ave, the landmark, what's going to be torn down. But when you think about preservation, you know, in 2017, it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, especially when you start talking about the digital world.
Absolutely.
What do we save on our computers? What do we save on our social media? What's worth preserving? You're right. Like, what do we take with us? And what are those things mean to us? It's a whole different ballgame when you talk about preservation in this day and age.
Absolutely. And preservation, when you think about a building or something, is much different. It's much easier to sort of wrap your head around why that might be important or how you might accomplish that. But you also have to think about preservation, as you're saying, digitally. And what are we choosing to save? What are we saving on hard drives? What are we uploading to the cloud? And also, what aren't we choosing to save? What's being saved for us that we don't realize? And who's the audience for that? How are we looking through that? It's suddenly we're creating so much data, it's become very complicated to think about preservation.
And it also is person to person, because some people will be a pack rat, and I have bins in my garage three high from the days of doing sketch comedy in Chicago that I open up one and it's just, you know, a poster here and an article here and a picture here, and I'm like, all of this stays. And I actually had a conversation with my 10-year-old son, and we had the conversation about preservation. I'm like, all of this stays because when I see it and I go through it, it elicits a feeling. It takes me back 20 years to a certain spot in a certain time that makes me feel something, makes me feel warm or whatever it might be. And sort of having that lesson about why these old papers mean anything. But that's changing.
Sure.
Because he's 10 years old. Most of his stuff's not even on. There is no poster. There is no crumpled up newspaper. That everything is online.
So for you, is preservation about nostalgia?
Mm-hmm. I think it is. I think it's about sort of trying to go back somewhere.
Finding home.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So is that our time? Are we up? Thank you.
We're
I'll
done.
Be back
yeah.
next Tuesday. That's great. No. All right. So let's talk about, so you start this project, Tanner, by saying, all right, I'm going to send a letter. I'm going to start the project. So you started with a handwritten letter to, like I said, friends, colleagues, and cultural icons to say, I want you to be involved. What is the letter that you sent?
Well, I can read you one. I brought one with
me. All right, good.
So it's very simple. I've written about 500 letters as part of this campaign. And I've gotten back about 50 responses, and I've written them sort of very broadly. I sort of pick an archetype of person, a movie director, for example, or a prisoner, and I'll write to 20 prisoners. And then I'll move on to the next archetype and start working through that. The letter usually says something to the effect of, hello, I'm working on a project that collects and publishes handwritten letters from prominent cultural figures. I would love to include yours and your handwriting. Could you please answer this? What's worth preserving? And that's it.
That's it.
Very simple.
And do they know the letter's coming? Or, I mean, it's just in the mail and they're like,
It's in the mail and I get an incredible amount of returned envelopes and also some very thoughtful rejection letters.
Do they really? Yeah. Handwritten?
Handwritten.
They're like, no, I don't want to. I'm not going to answer this for a number of reasons.
Right.
And they go and give you four pages. Okay, so who are you sending? I mean, how many people have you seen? You said over 500 letters now. Uh-huh. And talk about the responses you've got. You've got a couple of examples here. Maybe we can read some of the letters that have come back. But what overall are you getting? What did you expect to get, and what are you getting back?
I expected to get a lot of handwritten letters, and I've been surprised to get a lot of things that aren't handwritten letters. For example, Matthew Hoffman, who just put a mural on the Apple Store recently.
Right. You are beautiful, right?
You are beautiful. He sent me a one-year supply of strawberry preserves, which I thought was wonderful. I'm still eating them. It hasn't been quite a year. I've also heard back from Cody Hudson. I got an original artwork today from him, actually, on the way to the studio. He is a principal at Land and Sea and Scribbling.
Yeah.
Art Paul, who designed the Playboy Bunny, wrote a letter. Seth Godin, who's a best-selling author of 22 books, hand-wrote a letter on a novelty-sized Post-it, a giant Post-it note, which is really lovely. As you mentioned, Elizabeth Crane, Jane Goodall, the UN Messenger of Peace. And
so they're being creative in their responses.
Absolutely.
It's not just like, here's my letter. They're really kind of buying into the question and expanding it even beyond the word.
And some responses have been a single word, and some have been 2,000 words. And that's been really exciting to see as well how they...
All right, Tanner, let's hear. What do you got? Give us an example. Let's read one of
these. I think we're going to start with the longest. I've got three I can read tonight if we have time.
Okay.
The first is Jerome Herman, and it's the longest I have. So let's jump in.
Okay.
Jerome is a powerful dancer using his cerebral palsy to lift up his choreography. As a professional dancer at Heidi Latsky Dance, Girona is defying every expectation, creating performances that inspire others to keep moving.
So okay, that's bio. That he didn't.
No, sorry, I should probably get some context instead of just jumping in there.
That was good context. I thought, like, that's how he starts letters, right. And you're like, oh, it's bio. That's cool. Yeah. All right, good.
Yeah. So I wrote that part.
Okay,
yeah.
You wrote that part. All right, here's a letter.
Okay, here's a letter. Dear Tanner, I've been thinking about this question nonstop ever since you posed it. What's worth preserving? Is the water filled my tub? What's worth preserving? Is I got a breather after a major combination in rehearsal? What's worth preserving? It isn't so much the question is unanswerable or leading, it's the opposite. Open. Individual. My answer will produce some form of alternative universe, or secure the current one. It'll be fulfilled or denied. My answer is my hope, curated by anecdotes of its presence. I know it's there. Remember when. I'll go personal. Last night I was in attendance at an event that woke up many ghosts. Dreams I had had that were broken and dormant. I was in a space that pushed out an exhale from me, a soothing exhaled breath I did not realize I was holding. I truly understood what weightless might mean. That is not the only example, but one truly potent example of the need for imagination. My answer. Imagination is worth preserving.
Hmm.
The spaces, people, impulses that enable it to grow and furnish apartments, marry with other imaginations, have babies, and see them graduate magna cum laude. To see twilight on their porches as their rocking chairs swing partly due to the wind and the vessel in the chair, to at one point sleep forever and leave behind heirs. Imagination is impartial, not a respecter of persons, which is why I like him. By the way, mine's a he. Yours can be a he, a she, or a they. He is audacious, which is often the necessary stance. He was with me when I was diagnosed with hemophilia cerebral palsy, a condition doctors said would and should limit my ability to fully live. Today, I'm a professional dancer and writer. I'd settle with the kind of mundane but powerful crown of faculty of reason previously thought to be out of reach. Compounded crowns, I'm a sucker for alliteration between diagnosis and dance, or some late-night talk, some pubescent provocations of the status of things. Definitely some myopia. I don't think imagination, at least in the beginning, can collaborate. It's too precious. It's like a germ. It changes once on the outside. It can't multiply. It can't strengthen without its host. So the first partnership between host and germ details the success of that germ. Will the host acquiesce to fever, illusion, hallucination, or take precaution? Because if the host does not, no other host will. The germ must compel. By imagination, I can mean many things, but I suppose imagination in and of itself is not the danger of extinction. Maybe a brand. To hearken back to my germ analogy, the strain unencumbered by too much influence is in danger. Should we preserve a pioneer strain? The strain most associated with childhood, when most things were more unknown, but it's the place where most feelings are felt. The law matrix. The raw matrix. And at this point, he hand drew a raw matrix in the letter. This is not so scientific, but compels me all the same. There's something inherent in the pioneer strain of imagination that remains throughout one's life. Whether they abandon it, formalize it, making it fit within normal modes of society, and capitalize or succumb to its original version, it remains in some form. Even if you don't imagine wrestling people to the ground in massive arenas at 8, I dare you to tell me you don't do that at 27. I think I'm colluding dreams with imagination a bit. This is a difficult question.
Well, let me stop there. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that you got that kind of response.
That's a
long letter. Handwritten letter.
And you wouldn't believe how fun it is to go to the mailbox these days.
All right. What else have you got there? Because you have a couple shorter ones,
sure,
too.
We
only got about 3 minutes left.
Jodi Picoult. This is a really short one. It's very lovely. So Jodi's an American author. She was awarded the New England Bookseller Award for Fiction in 2003.
She's great.
She's wonderful. She sold 14 million books. She said on 27th June 2017, "What would I preserve? Voices. It's that which I miss the most. My eldest son's scratchy voice as a baby. My daughter at 5 messing up all pronouns. My grandfather saying, 'Hey, girl,' when I called. We take pictures, but we don't forget the sound of a beloved lullaby or a holiday concert solo or even the smile and the sound of someone we've lost to death." X. Jodi.
Wow. It is true. I mean, that's a great one. That's amazing.
She's so lovely. It gives me goosebumps every time I read
it. Yeah, that's just, I mean, that's a tremendous, I mean, that's what we all try to preserve, right? Voice,
that's right.
That's good. What are you going to do with all this? I mean, you have a Kickstarter because you want to put this project together. You want to make a book out of these.
That's right.
Is that what you're going for with this project?
That is, yeah. So we've also published them every week to our members. So every week we have an exclusive letter we publish online. But really, when you see them in the book and you see the sort of the full portfolio of responses, it's much more meaningful.
You got one more, right? You got a short one?
I sure do. It's
Let's do two more minutes.
This one's a little too long, I think. Let me jump in. Cut me off. I need to cut me off.
All right.
This is from Alyssa Tenney, who is the president of SAIC.
Yep.
Hers is really wonderful, too. Dear Tanner, as a college president, I know people pursue all kinds of things when they begin a course of study. Knowledge, skills, a degree, the promise of a better job with a higher salary. They pursue attention for their work and distinction in their field. They pursue a dream of a better self, who's a more urbane, sophisticated, aware, and connected citizen of the world. School is an aspirational place, and these are all worthwhile pursuits. But most students and educators find it is not the goal or the recognition or the transformed self per se that's most important or lasting. It's the love of inquiry that is the key. No matter how materially better our lives become because of our study, the asking of the question and pursuing its answer, which is most often another question, is what animates a lifetime.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's so awesome.
Isn't that great?
What do you think's worth preserving?
I'm trying to figure it out, man. I have no idea.
This is what a great project, man. I am over the moon that you're doing this.
Thank you.
This is so cool. And I hope you figure that out, because
sure.
When you figure out what you think is worth preserving, I'd love to have you back.
Yeah.
In studio tonight, Tanner Woodford. He's the founder and executive director at the Chicago Design Museum. He's got a new project. The name of the project is What's Worth Preserving.
Sure is.
And there's a Kickstarter out there as well. You can find that. And like I said, it's handwritten letters asking prominent people what's worth preserving and their responses, handwritten responses, which we just heard a couple of them tonight. Tanner, can't thank you enough for coming in and sharing some of that stuff, and we appreciate it. And please come back when you figure out the question.
Great.
The
Thanks so much for having me.
You can find out all that information at shydm.com/book. Shydm. So CHIDM. That's Chicago Design Museum. I love that story. Gosh, what a great, that's, you know, I want to do that with my life, right? To be able to get existential questions answered by prominent cultural figures in the country of just the simple question, what's worth preserving? And I would assume that it's generational. Great. I mean, the response of voice. Yeah, that's what's worth preserving. The voices of your family. But also, I mean, there's so much. It's so interesting because it's funny. I just had this moment. My son could care less, of course, as I'm bent over the bin going, oh, look at this poster. look at this flyer that we used to hang on telephone poles on, you know, Lunt in Rogers Park. I'm like, this is we made these at the Kinko's. This is different. There was no computer to make this. We had to make this in the spot.
Okay.
And I'm like, well, it reminds me of something, man. There's something there,
yeah,
that hits the heartstrings. So for Tanner, what a project. But he should think about posing that question to different generations.
Right.
You know, I would think that someone younger like my son or someone who might be in their early teens would have a different understanding of what that means, just based on a life in which they don't collect things the way we did.
Your son is probably not interested in preserving old VHS tapes of Will and Grace, like myself.
Like yourself. Exactly. But what a great segment to almost preview Swap Meet. Swap Meet coming up at 10 o'clock. That's what all that's about. What did you preserve?
Yeah.
What did you feel you needed to preserve? Whether or not, you know, it's worth money. That's the fun part with Greg. Comes in and tells you, oh, you're sitting on a gold mine, or that's not worth what you think it's worth. But you kept it for a reason. Obviously, that reason primarily was I might make money off of this someday. But a lot of times when people call up, what they're calling up with is what they collected. Their memorabilia. The word memory is the root word there. And I think that that's worthwhile. So tonight when we do the swap meet coming up, tell me, why did you preserve it? What's worth preserving? I mean, you're telling us what's worth preserving. And it's kind of a nice little tie-in. Before we do that, though, Rich Cohen coming up here, talk about what it means to be a Cubs fan in 2017 as they get ready to take on the Washington Nationals on Friday. Rich Cohen, my guest, coming up after the news. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, when my next guest, author Rich Cohen, was a kid, his father gave him some great advice. After watching a particular Cubs loss at Wrigley in 1976, Herb Cohen told his son, "Promise me you won't become a Cubs fan. The team will screw up your life." Of course, that meant Rich had to become the biggest diehard fan, but it remains to be seen if his dad's warning of a diminished life determined by low expectations has come true. It's a different segment, Rich. But in terms of bleeding Cubby Blue, this much is true. The Cubs are defending world champions, which is almost in stark contrast to what wearing a Cubs hat stood for decade after decade. You aren't a world champ. You're a baseball fan who appreciates the game because there's nothing else to appreciate, especially winning. In his new book, The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse, Rich Cohen writes of curses and Cubs history, as well as his own life story, a memoir of sorts that celebrates futility at the friendly confines. Rich Cohen has written several books, including Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears, and The Wild Heart of Football, and has written for pretty much every other publication on earth. A regular on this show, Rich Cohen, welcome back. Good to see you.
Very glad to be back.
You know, this book is perfectly timed as the Cubs embark on their journey to defend their world championship. What's it mean to you to be in Chicago right now? I mean, it's a much different feeling than it was last year, but what does it mean to be here this week right before the Cubs get back on that track?
It's exciting. It's confusing. I feel somewhat in a strange world, Alice in Wonderland, you know? I mean, when I was a kid, basically the summer ended when the baseball season ended. I think it's warm out now because of that, because the summer continues as long as the Cubs are playing. You know, and you said I wrote the book Monsters. The reason I wrote Monsters, the reason I got so into the Bears was in 1984, in the event that made me a writer, because it gave me a tragic sensibility. The Cubs, up 2-0 and needing only one game, collapsed to the horrible San Diego Padres. And I feel like I almost died, like I almost physically died. And I was only brought back to life by the 85 Bears, who were knocking everybody out and getting my revenge on the world.
That really is true for all Chicagoans. It almost never gets spoken about that the Chicago Bears and how great they were in the 85 season had a lot to do with the fact that the Cubs failed so miserably in 1984.
Right. It's like you're laughing at us now. Well, here comes the 46 defense.
For you to be in Chicago and to be a kid who grew up in Glencoe, but, you know, when you're in Chicago, this story and a lot of the stuff in here is very familiar. For anyone who's lived in Chicago, we know about the stories of all these players. But being in New York and in your life and other places, when you talk about being a Cubs fan, what does it mean to someone who's not from Chicago?
Well, first of all, there's this great thing where there is a diaspora of Cub fans all over the country and all over the world. And it's amazing when you watch different games, like half the crowd always seems to be Cubs fans. And I went on the road with the Cubs in 2000 for like a bunch of weeks, and everywhere we went, Cubs fans. So that's great, because you can be walking through a crowd in New York and you see a guy in a Cubs hat and you both kind of quietly nod to each other. You both share the secret life, you know. Mostly being in New York and being a Cubs fan makes you feel righteous and better, because Mets fans are the worst. My father was a Yankees fan. He grew up in New York. He was born and raised in Brooklyn and was a Yankees fan just to piss people off, I think, in Brooklyn, because there was the Dodgers. So it makes you feel, you know, that's always the thing about being a Cubs fan, and that's the thing that's being challenged now, which is, I always felt like as a Cubs fan, you were the natural, you were the Buddhist of the national game. You know, you learned to live in the here and now because there was no future for you.
You're more appreciation. You're a real fan.
Yeah, you could appreciate Ivan DeJesus driving the ball into the corner and driving in Barry Foote. And that was great, man. And that was as good as it was going to get. And I feel like, you know, when you wore a Cubs hat, it really was. It's like you were saying, my kingdom is not of this world, you know. And the weird thing is, I always did feel as a Cubs fan, the journey and being on the road trip that never ends was so much part of it. What happened last fall is we got where we were going.
Right.
And when you get where you're going, you kind of don't know what to do.
I like the concept of it almost being like brand identity. When you see someone with a Yankees hat on, there's this corporate kind of baseball thing to it. And you mentioned the Mets. It's almost they win by miracles, the miracle
right.
Mets. But when you see the Cubs, there is this idea that they're the lovable losers. There's an appreciation for baseball. But that brand, it's so funny, that C on the hat, it has to change now.
It's already changed. I mean, I think Theo Epstein realized it had to change for them to win. And he also realized that if there is a curse, it's obviously not a metaphysical curse. It's like a bad corporate culture, you know, and that you have to change the culture because the history is so heavy it weighed on the players. I feel like I felt it during the World Series. Like when the Cubs got out of Wrigley Field in the World Series, they played so much better because they were loose and free. They felt everybody's longing put so much pressure on them. You know, when Joe Maddon describes coming to Wrigley Field and having to go through all the people carrying the ashes of their grandparents who didn't live to see, I mean, all that weighs on the players. And I think that Epstein realized that, you know, a young player would come up and he'd be sitting with, I don't know, Bill Buckner, and something would go wrong and he'd say, ah, here we go again, you know. and that the, what the Cubs needed was they needed a very young team because young people are basically stupid. They don't know anything about history, so they're not burdened. And also he needed to bring them up all right at the same time. So that team, this team, was kind of grown almost like in a greenhouse in the minors. And they just brought them all up, not on the same day, but within a couple of years. And then even the veterans weren't Cubs veterans. They were guys like David Ross, who came from different teams, you know.
John Lester, right.
Yeah,
right,
they brought right. the old guys. They need some of the old guys, you know, so they brought them in from other teams.
Not old Cubs, old guys.
You need always need some old guys around. Right. It's very helpful. Old guys are really underrated right now, but they're important. So they were around, and they helped the Cubs, and you created this other tradition where these players, like my kids, who are little kids, believe, wow, the Cubs are excellent. You know, they're more excellent than the Yankees. They're very professional. You know, whereas I read this story about in 1979, which was when I was 10, the year I really became my most serious year, Mike Vail was a right fielder for the Cubs, and he was throwing out a runner sliding at home, and he sailed the throw and knocked out the ball boy who was just standing there. That's such a beautiful metaphor for what it was like to be a Cubs fan in the 70s. You thought you were at a safe distance, but you might get knocked out at any time.
For everything that you said, especially when you talk about what's on the field, we're so aware of that story, and that's what makes it so much more momentous in sports history, that guys like Chris Bryant, Addison Russell, and Anthony Rizzo will be remembered for what they accomplished. Psychologically, as a fan, and you think about that, does it change your perception of being a Cubs fan, for you being world champions, defending world champions, as you get ready to watch these games? Do you watch them in a different way? Do you think about your fandom in a different way now that they've gotten over the hump and broke the curse?
Well, you said that my father said I shouldn't be a Cubs fan because it will give me lower expectations. I'll expect human effort to end in loss. And he was right, you know, because the fact is, I thought when the Cubs won the World Series, I'd be a different guy. I might be much taller, you know, better looking. I mean, but basically you get right around to it, and it happens. It's I realize it's baked in. It's who I am. It's my sensibility is kind of like when things start to go wrong, I expect the wheels to come off. I remember last year I was at the Wrigley Field during the NLCS, and the Cubs were winning and the Dodgers came back and tied the game. I think it was the first game. And as soon as they tied the game, it felt to me more like they were 10 runs ahead. I don't know why. I'm like, oh, God, there's no way they're going to win this game.
Right.
And all the people who were young sitting around me started to chant something, and I couldn't understand what they were saying. And I turned to the sports reporter next to me, and I said, what are they saying? He said, they're chanting, we don't quit. I was like, who are these people? What are they talking about? We do quit. That's who we are. We're the people that quit.
We're proud of it.
So it's a total new mentality that I admire, but I don't quite have.
You mentioned, you know, your kids, and it's funny because you dedicate the book to the kids saying, growing up, thinking that the Cubs are one of the greatest teams of all time. When you think about that, you think about growing up, because my dad used to tell me all the time, and I never took him seriously, and now I think back about it, and I totally agree. When the Bears were great in the 80s, and even into Jordan in the 90s, he was saying, you got it so good. Chicago's got it. You right now, you don't understand how bad it was in the 60s and the 70s for Chicago sports across the board. He would always say that. Even when we're scoring touchdowns, when Dicka and the Bears are winning, he'd be like, you guys enjoy it because it
right.
was not like this before. Are you that kind of dad? Are you,
yeah,
are you
actually,
finding yourself doing that now?
Actually, you said it's a different show, like I need a psychiatrist, but you just made me realize something, which is my father, as I said, grew up in New York as a Yankee fan, okay? Part of the reason he's probably a Yankee fan is the Yankees won every year. I don't know what the record was, but when they had those teams, first with Joe DiMaggio,
yeah.
then with Mickey Mantle, they won every year. And he was moved out here for business, you know, before I was born. And I grew up here, and I'm a Chicagoan, and I love Chicago. Because he was a New Yorker, he would always be like, do you like that corned beef sandwich? They have better corned beef in New York. It was always in my ear. I was like, would you shut up? Do you like this play? The original version in New York was better. And it was this constant thing that drove me nuts. It was saying sort of my life was somehow less or fraudulent compared to his life. And really the ultimate of that was I was a Cubs fan. He was a Yankees fan.
Right.
And so this is hugely satisfying because my team, well, we'll find out. Now, the best thing would be a Cubs-Yankees World Series. Knock on wood, because that was 1932, Cubs-Yankees, Babe Ruth called shot.
Man.
It's time to get revenge for that. You know, but with my kids, you know, at first I felt bad that they were becoming Cubs fans because they were watching what I do, because I thought, oh, my God, I'm handing it down to another generation. I'm a monster, you know? Why am I doing this? But the thing about the Cubs is it's more than a, you know, baseball team. It's a whole culture, a whole way of life, and I'm very glad that they're Cubs fans, and I do tell them to be appreciative, but mostly I'm just happy that they're growing up as normal citizens of the world, not expecting to lose all the time. They have it all. I mean, I honestly thought Wrigley Field's the best place to see a baseball game. Can you imagine seeing a game here that matters?
Right.
And they have that.
I wonder, I mean, as someone who lives here in Chicago and you see the changes, it's amazing to see what they've done to Wrigley Field, and they're creating a space around it, parks and hotels. It almost reminds me of if you go out west and you see like San Diego Padres Stadium. I mean, we all know what Wrigley Field is, but what they're doing around it, this team is a team that doesn't necessarily follow in any of the footsteps of the Chicago Cubs, even traditional romanticism, anything. They're winners juxtaposed against the losers. Do we run the risk of losing all of this romanticism and this culture and everything you talked about, this idea of being the lovable losers with what's happening right now? And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's just like falling in love, man. You always risk something, you know? I mean, it's always risky to change things. And I was a very big purist as a kid about no lights, you know? But then I kind of thought it would be nice before I died to see a team win. And I think all the changes that they make is almost part of the mentality. It's connected to the same mentality that allows them to win.
Right.
I went for this book and spent some time with Ricketts, and it's like he showed me the model of what he was doing. I thought, this is what it must have been like when William Wrigley took over and was trying stuff, you know? And out of the Cubs organization came Bill Veeck Jr., who tried stuff.
Right.
You know, so yeah, you change things, you lose things, but, you know, kind of I'm got to the point where I really don't want to live in a museum. And I think one of the most important things for people to be successful is to be – you have to be willing to make mistakes. And there's no doubt they could make mistakes and they could screw it up, but at least things are happening, you know?
Yeah. It's such a great story, and I'm just laughing at the idea of one of the founders of the Cubs who are like, this is where the yum yum donuts will go.
Right, right. Yeah, that's what he was like, though. That's exactly what he was like. And the fact is that the team got bad when Wrigley's son took over and he didn't really care about winning, you know? So – I mean, it's the kind of Chicago attitude.
It really is fascinating to me because it almost flies in the face of sports and sports fandom when you think about it, because you just said it right there. When ownership takes over, they don't care about winning. We see that in some organizations and some sports and different towns, and there's a mutiny.
Right.
We won't stand for this. We need new ownership. This we have it here in Chicago, I mean, on the football side. But with the Cubs, it's baked into the culture. It's a strange thing. It's probably the only team, I think, in all of sport where losing actually is romanticized.
Right. Well, Phil Wrigley was brilliant because he realized he wasn't going to field a great team and he didn't want that park to be empty. So he made the famous Faustian bargain where he said, we got to give them a reason to come to the park, so we'll make the park itself the reason. And often when I was a kid, you feel like you're kind of having a picnic and there's some guys in the distance doing something that doesn't really involve you, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was the Cubs. And that really worked. So when Bill Veeck Jr. actually plants the ivy, it's something that we celebrate, but it also marks a real scary moment where they've kind of given up, you know, on winning, and then losing becomes raised up to this thing and being the purists, you know, more Catholic than the Catholic Church. Like, we're going to do the Mass in Latin. Like, we're going to have day games, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And it becomes almost like, you know, what's interesting is it is a business, ultimately. And it's very typical of what happens when there's, like, a founder who does a lot, and then his sort of son takes over who doesn't really care. But what the difference is, you see the product on the field, where normally you just realize that the gum doesn't taste quite as good as it used to, but you can't put your finger on it.
And I guess tonight, Rich Cohen is the author of The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse. He's also the author of Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears, and The Wild Heart of Football. Rich is going to be up at the bookstall in Winnetka coming up tomorrow night. That's 8 o'clock start?
6:30.
6:30 start, and a 6:30 again at the Hideout on Friday as guest on Mark Baser's The Interview Show. Rich, always great to see you. And as the Cubs rumble through the playoffs, if they do by chance get to a Yankees-Cubs World Series, you got to come back.
Absolutely. I'll come back wearing Babe Ruth's pants.
There you go. Great to see you.
Great to see you.
Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Greg Flamm in the swap meet, 312-981-7200. We'll talk about your collectibles. We'll evaluate your memorabilia and your junk. What do you want to brag about? Tonight's the night. Greg's in studio. We didn't have a chance to do it last week, I think because the Cubs clinched. It's hard to believe it's only been a week since that happened, but great to have him on. Obviously, it'll be more sporadic as time goes on because of the Blackhawks as their season starts tomorrow night. when they play, we don't. But Greg Flamm in the building tonight, so we will talk with him about the swap meet. I'm excited about that. I hope that more people come out tonight and share what they've preserved, what they've decided to preserve. You know, there's obviously the question of what it's worth, but also why you kept it. That's always fun when you get a couple questions in. Then you find out they're like, well, I was a big Star Wars fan. 312-981-7200. The swap meet coming up next.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure. Like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flamm.
That's me.
There he is, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Greg Flamm, the Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. This is a segment where every Wednesday night we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. We find out what you want to brag about. What do you want to brag about, and what is it worth? That's what Greg's here for. Greg, how are you, my man?
I'm doing great. Nice week off. It was refreshing. Gave me a chance to pick some new stuff.
Well, how is it with the summer, of course, winding down?
Yeah, winding down. But, you know, the flea markets are still packed and, you know, still able to find something. I mean, I pretty much took the week off. I'm just kind of like, you know, at the end of the summer, kind of slowing down a little bit. I didn't mind not picking too much during the week.
Take a weekend for yourself.
Yeah, but, you know, I still found some cool stuff. I found this within the last week. These
all
items
right,
here we're going to
talk
about.
All right, here we go. Let's see what you got here. You've got some T-shirts.
Yep. So, you know, now here's the segment that's going to make everyone run to their closet and see what they have back there, because it is really,
let's do
you
it.
Have no idea what these shirts are worth. And if I ask you which one of the three is worth the
most,
let's try that
first. Hold on. Okay, so I see we've got a Pearl Jam caricature T-shirt where
and
they're hanging on the...
There's European tour dates on the back or the tour countries.
Classic.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like it was done by the guy from Navy Pier who will... the caricature.
Right.
You've got a classic, the Cub fan Bartman.
Right.
Don't have a cow, Harry.
Right.
Bleacher bum Bart Simpson. And then what's this black one? This is a
Pearl Jam 5.
Pearl Jam 5 with the hand, yeah.
And the side graphic.
And there you go. All right, so which one is, I would say the Cub fan Bartman.
You're close. The Pearl Jam caricature and the Cubs fan are about $90
each.
$90? Yeah.
That is, I'd do the $90 for Cub fan.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to get that much for it. But, but the Pearl Jam shirt is a $250 shirt.
What?
Yep, this shirt right here is $250.
Why? What makes it $250?
I'm assuming, here's the background. It's Pearl Jam. It's got a five and a circle on it, and it's five against one. And that they changed the name of the album to Versus. That was the Versus album.
Okay.
But it was going to be called Five Against One. So I guess so these are kind of more rare, or it's kind of like that Star Wars thing where they changed the name.
Oh, right.
Like,
it's like if you
mid-production
could come across
or something.
The World Champion Atlanta Falcons T-shirt. Right?
right.
Because they pressed those early.
And plus, it's double-sided with the side sleeve graphic as well.
Look at that thing.
So, yeah, so there is money in T-shirts. And
there's money in T-shirts.
People are going to be running their closets now and see what they have.
I know. I've already got two that I want to try out on you. Ready?
All right.
I've got one that's a Yo MTV Raps T-shirt.
Yeah.
Got that in a Florida mall.
Okay.
With a couple of quarters. Like whatever was left on a spring break back in the day. Yo MTV Raps.
Okay.
Classic. I've also got a Mike Ditka T-shirt where it's a watercolor of him.
Oh, okay.
So it's someone took a painting that was a watercolor of Ditka and pressed it onto a T-shirt.
Wow.
And then I have a third one that I love, which is the one that actually, I still have it. My brother lost it, but it's a Daily or a Jane Byrne. I can't remember. It was like C. Dick Run. See Jane Wynn
or something like that.
It was a blue one. It was like, it was just block letters.
Right.
And I think I've told the story before, but I saw a kid wearing it ironically in a music studio.
Nice.
And we were in there because we were shooting some stuff with the green screen, and I saw him in there, you know, toying with the bass or something.
Yeah.
I'm like, hey, what's with that shirt? He's like, I don't know, man. I go, I'll give you money right now if you give it to me off your back. And he said, okay.
And that's not the first time I've heard that. Not off of my back, but I've heard other people say that.
$20 is what I gave him.
Right.
And then it was too small because he was like, he was kind of like a, right, he was a, he's a little hipster,
you know,
right?
Guy,
a, yeah, a little rocker hipster guy. So, and I'm a little firmer.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get it to fit. So I gave it to my brother, who was a little brother, and he was more of that kind of that stature.
Right.
And then I asked him about it not too long ago, and he's like, I don't know where that's at. And I'm like, what's the matter with you? So that's where we're at. That's
well, some of the
story.
Yo MTV Raps stuff is like $80 to $180.
It's not in good condition.
Okay. The hoodie is $190. T-shirts are about $80.
Well, that's 60, crazy.
$60 to $80 just for that, yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's money there. And
things are looking up.
Yep. So let's see what people
all
have.
All right, let's see. Let's go to Kathy. Kathy, start us off tonight, Kathy. What do you want to brag about, Kathy?
Well, I went to a Cal Bears game against Stanford back in, I believe, 1983.
Uh-oh.
There were five lateral passes.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they ran in, and Ron Rivera was on the Bears.
Wow.
And they ran in against John Elway for a touchdown.
Yeah, of course. So, that's when they ran over the trumpet to trombone player, right? Wasn't that the game, right?
Yep.
So Cal made a T-shirt out of it for the next season. And it's a gold T-shirt. It's got the it's got the grid on it. It has the five lateral passes. It has the band on the field with the trombone player over. It has a bunch of notes. So we bought those T-shirts in would have been the following year.
Wow. All right. Let's see if that shows up. Yeah. That's great. That's a fun reference T-shirt, at least.
It is. It's not showing up, though, but I had something else that showed up. It's some kind of 25th anniversary T-shirt, but that was only $13. But I'm sure yours is worth quite a bit.
Why
more.
Did you? I mean, after all these years, because this is going to be a fun segment tonight. We start talking about T-shirts.
Yep.
What made you preserve it? Why'd you keep it as you move from place to place, from drawer to drawer? You needed extra
right.
space in the closet.
Another bin.
It was actually stolen from me once.
What?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was.
How'd you get it back?
Camp up in the mountains.
Okay.
And we did laundry and. The guys did laundry, and I went to get mine, and it was gone.
Wow.
And so I went over to the senior camp counselor, and I said to him, my T-shirt will return to me tonight.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it did?
But it will return. I'm a camp nurse. So
okay, gotcha.
I get a little authority.
Well, there you go.
Glad that was a happy
All
ending.
All right, a happy ending. Thanks, Kathy. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All right. That's a good one. The Cal Stanford.
Stanford, yeah.
All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. If you got some T-shirts in the back of the closet, I'm going to think of some other ones. I got a T-shirt from the Blues Festival. Would have been like 1995, 1996. Okay. Got a couple Jazz Festival T-shirts as well.
Okay.
I got a couple of – I got an Eric Kramer jersey. I mean, I keep going. I can keep going. 312-981-7200 to swap meet tonight. Greg Flam's in the building. And if you want to get in on the action, that's the number to call. You can text or call. Stay with us. It's swap meet, 312-981-7200. I'm Justin Kaufman. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter, is also in studio with us tonight as we break down what your stuff is worth, right?
Right. Bring it.
All right, so let's get to some of these texts. We've got some great texts coming in. Why don't we start with the let me start right here. 708, a lot of less sports stuff tonight.
Okay.
I have a baseball signed by A.J. Pierzynski and a poster of him and the team celebrating after winning the 2005 World Series, both authenticated. What are they worth? Russ wants to know.
Okay. Signed A.J. Pierzynski balls are about 35 to 50 is what I'm seeing. The jersey obviously would be more up. What was the other item? A poster?
Yeah, a poster.
That. If it's just him, again, you're probably in the 25 to 35 range on that.
Yeah, well, it's not so bad.
But it's not bad.
I mean, it's A.J. Pierzynski.
Right.
Let's,
he was one of my favorites.
He was.
Every team has to have that guy, you know.
I will say this. I want to change the subject. A.J. Pierzynski's weird phantom called third strike, yep. dropped third strike run against the Angels in that playoff series.
Yep.
Changed the whole course of, at that point, we're like, I don't know if they're going to get past the Angels. And he did that as either game one
right.
or game two.
I mean, obviously, Creedy had to do what he did afterwards and everything like that had to fall into place. But, yeah, he extended the inning that, to make that happen.
With a totally bogus play. All right, moving on. 815 says, I have Marvel Comics Star Wars.
All right.
Volume 1, May 1983.
Okay. Mm. Couldn't find the volume 1. Well, volume 1, obviously, I can find, but the number, what was the issue number? Does he
it
have
doesn't
that?
Have that. It just says Marvel Comics Star Wars, Volume 1, May 1983.
Yeah. Okay. The lot of them have gone for about $200. In fair condition. I mean, they don't have that. That wasn't mint
How
condition.
Much?
$200 for
okay.
a lot of maybe 10
right.
or 12.
Okay.
Just an individual issue I found, number 73, one for $80 recently, to give you an idea.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, not bad.
All right. Let's keep going here. We've got a can of Coho Cola.
Yeah.
Steve Dahl days. Some JQ in Lamont.
Yep.
He's got a picture of it, too. The Loop FM 98 Coho Cola.
Yeah, I remember, obviously, I'm a big Steve Dahl fan, so, I mean, I collect that stuff, and if I saw that this week, I would buy it. But two cans are about $19 for two cans. I don't know if they were empty or full, if they preserved mm-hmm. them that way or not. But, yeah, they should ask for more because that was they were the only ones on there sold or available. So I think they could be worth more, 25, yeah. maybe 30.
All right, there you go. Let's go to Dave. Dave, what do you want to brag about, Dave?
Well, I have seven of the last World Series shirts with the losers as actually the winners.
What?
And I have five of the last Super Bowl championships, but the losers as the winners.
How did you get those? Do you just scour the net to find that stuff because you're into the kitsch of it?
No, I'm just in that industry. And when we print it, we print ahead of time.
Right.
And then the company comes in and they keep kind of closed tabs, and they make them all disappear, let's say.
Yeah, they go to, Argentina or something, wherever they ship them to when they don't win.
They're made to be disappeared,
yep.
right?
So maybe you can tell us about that. But, yeah, I have no idea what that's worth, but there's definitely, obviously, would be a market for that.
You know, Dave.
Especially if selling as a lot, if you got, like, five of the losers, like, all grouped together. I think that would be worth more than just selling one at a time.
I think that's awesome.
Yeah,
and I also would say, Dave, our last hour we talked about what's worth preserving. Why do you hold on to that stuff? What is it about holding on and keeping that stuff around? Are you looking for a payday or just love the idea that you have this kitschy thing in sports history?
Yeah, it's something that, nobody else is going to have because they make them all disappear, and it's being in the industry, it's kind of fun to have. So you hold on to it and say, hey, you know what? Yeah, they didn't win, but guess what? I got all the T-shirts. I have all the winning T-shirts, too, but
right.
it's nice to match them up and have them together and say, hey, I got them both.
I love it.
Yeah,
that's
great.
Do you frame them and put them on a wall, or are they just buried in a drawer somewhere?
No, I have them put away in paper so they last for a little while.
Right.
It's kind of cool to see the designs, 2-3 weeks before they actually come out, too. So,
yeah, that's
can
cool.
you say what company you work for in Chicago when you print them, or are you still printing now?
I'd rather not.
No, that's all right. I just thought
Greg was
because I had that Dennis Rodman Hypercolor shirt, and that was made in Chicago. That's why I was wondering. I think it was Chicago Trends was the company that made it.
Oh, made it, yeah,
yeah. But yeah,
Dave, thanks for calling, man. That's cool.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Thanks.
Take care. Yeah, I like that a lot. All right, let's keep going here. On the same vein, 815 says they have a 96 Bulls championship shirt and hat combo.
Yeah, I mean, if it's never been worn, maybe $30 for each. Maybe a little bit higher for the hat, maybe.
What about worn?
Worn, 25 for both, and yeah. So,
I had those shirts, those bear or the Bulls 96,
Bulls, yeah.
But I would wear them.
Right.
And then they would get yellow in inappropriate underarm places. And then they're not worth anything at that point.
Right.
I'm not going to. All right.
That's your sentimental section there at that point.
847 says, I have an autographed poster of the 1985 Chicago Honey Bears.
Nice.
Wouldn't it be the 84 Honey Bears? Am I not? And maybe I'm wrong on this, but weren't the Honey Bears, didn't they stop before the World Champion, or were they still there? It was right after the World Series or the Super Bowl?
Yeah, I had that one when. And Pete pointed out that Cheryl Burton was on that squad. I brought that in that one time. And it was signed by someone else in the squad. But Yeah, I'm still trying to sell that. I can't get $30-$35 for
really?
It. So yeah.
You would think that that would be like a
But I think, you know, I'm holding on. I think someone will still pay $25-$30 for it.
Huh. 847 says they have a Walter Payton, which we've talked about a lot. Signed, framed, perfect condition.
A poster?
It just says shirt. Walter Payton signed, framed.
Okay.
So I'm guessing
probably a poster, yeah. Yeah, Payton stuff, obviously, anything does pretty well. And a signed poster, I'd have to say you're in the 100 to 150 range.
Wow. There you go. All right, and then before we go to break, 847 says, I have a Bears Jay Cutler jersey from about 6 years ago. How much do I have to pay someone else to take it off my hands?
Right.
Does that? But, I mean, he is now going to be a moment. I'm ready to be ironic about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready to wear my Cutler jersey out and be like, remember Cutler?
Yep. I have like a 14-inch plush doll of Cutler. I'm holding on to that. At some point, you know,
it's
going to be worth something.
All right. So 312-981-7200. We got some people on the line. Linda, stay with us. Got a lot of great texts coming through. We'll take a quick break here. We'll come back. We'll get the news with Rob, and we'll come back, and we'll do a second half of the Swap Meet. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Here we are.
There we are. At DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Greg's here every Wednesday. As we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk, we got a lot of people on the line. 312-981-7200. We got some texts as well. Let's get right to it. Why don't we start with Linda? Linda, what do you want to brag about, Linda?
Well, I'm decluttering and downsizing, and I've run across some old records. I forgot we even had. My parents bought the house, and they're from way back in the 40s with Dennis Day. And there's even a couple of Caruso in them, and they're all in real good condition.
Okay.
Wow. That's awesome.
Wow. Trying to get you some prices here.
Sure.
Who'd you say? Caruso. Who's the first one?
Dennis Day.
Day.
And then the other one was Enrique Caruso.
Enrique Caruso.
Okay.
They just don't make good names like that for the pop stars of today. Enrique Caruso. I like that name.
Yep.
Okay, so 40s records, LPs, I'm assuming.
Are they 78s?
They're
like
78.
Yeah.
That's, there you go.
Yeah, and I think a couple are even one-sided.
Wow.
Yeah, they're definitely between the 100 to 300 range, depending on condition.
Wow.
So
okay,
how do they look to you?
Each?
Yeah, each. You know, do you see a lot of scratches? Were they in the sleeves? How were they stored?
These are... albums that were bought and they were put in individual sleeves.
Okay.
So where you open them up and it's like a book.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, if you don't see many scratches on them, you're probably, you know, 150 to 300.
Oh, that's great.
Okay. Where can I go to find this out? I mean, you know.
Obviously, online you can look. There's a couple record websites, discogs.com. I'm trying to think of the other one. If you write me through DuPage Picker, I'll send you the info on that to look them up.
Okay. Right. And what is your, where do you write to you for?
Facebook, DuPage Picker at Facebook or
at
Twitter.
DuPage Picker. All right. Thanks, Linda.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Right, thank you.
There you go. All right. So about that. All right. Let's keep going. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Zach. Zach, what do you want to brag about, Zach?
Yeah. I have a original T-shirt from the Pink Floyd At the Wall tour that was in Germany, nice. Along with pieces of the Berlin Wall after it had fallen down.
Wow.
How'd you get those out?
Well, I'm only 26 years old. I'm actually an Army brat, so my parents were there at the time, and I was born over there in Germany.
There you go.
So I have, you know, pictures of them, you know, taking a piece of the wall and everything just so they could document it and say, you know, this isn't fake. So
yeah, that's amazing.
I was completely befuddled when I had a fifth grade project, and my mom's like, oh, here, bring this to class and show them.
That's a nice show and tell, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's awesome.
When we got the you know, preview of what you were going to talk about, just Pink Floyd shirts in general, if their concert shirts from Pink Floyd are $250.
Wow.
And yours obviously would surpass that quite a bit, especially with the pieces of, you know, the wall and everything. I mean, you know, you could be in $800,000 range, maybe more. And I think it'd be more because you're going to get quite a few bids on that.
That's really cool, though. I don't know. I mean, you can't. I don't know if you can really get rid of that, though.
Right.
Yeah, I don't even know if you can sell it legally. I don't know if it's considered, like, you know, wartime memorabilia or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
But even just the T-shirt, you know, you probably still could be in the, you know, 500 range and definitely do an auction on that if you do sell it.
Oh, cool.
But, you know, you won't have to worry about authenticating or illegally selling parts of the wall.
I just had a thought in my head. I'm like, Zach, you're up next. Justin, your turn. I'm like, mine is the history of the river. They reversed it. Zach, your turn. I've got the Berlin Wall. Oh, okay. B. C-minus for Zach on that one.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks, buddy.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks, guys.
That was good, man. That's good stuff.
That is rare.
All right, let's go to Jefferson. Jefferson.
Hey, you know, Justin, I got to tell you real quick before I get shut off. I love you, and I love listening to Steve Grzanich.
Yeah, Grzanich.
You two are the only voices of reason on that station. thank you very much.
Well, thank you,
Jefferson. A couple things. When Linda was on, another object came to mind, so I'll make it real quick.
Okay.
And then I'll just ask one quick question. So I have, and it is worn, 1983 White Sox winning ugly T-shirt.
That's such a good T-shirt. That's such a good T-shirt.
And then I thought about this when Linda was on the phone. I have, and it's not, the record is in mint condition. The sleeve is not, a 45 of the Super Bowl Shuffle.
Okay.
And then I have on an autograph from Steve Avellini to my aunt, or great aunt, who was a waitress at the Golden Ox, signed on a Golden Ox menu.
You mean Bob Avellini, right? The quarterback?
Bob Avellini,
On a menu.
If you remember the Golden Ox, it was at North and Clybourne. And then I had a question I haven't heard anyone ask this. What do you think the value is of a mint condition Farrah Fawcett poster that so many guys had in the 70s? I mean, the point of reference I would have to use would be it was on the back door of the bedroom. And,
right, that's where you had to put it because, you know, I had one and the parents didn't want it, like, out in the open, so I had to put it on the inside of a closet, you know, door.
Yeah, Fast Times at Ridgemont High is probably the only point of reference I can come up with. And then I'll run. That's it.
All right. Thanks, Jefferson. Thanks, buddy.
Really
thanks,
love your show, Jefferson.
Thank you, man.
All right, I'll try to zip through these.
So let's get through this. Winning Ugly.
Winning Ugly shirt. There's a bunch of them on here. They're selling for about $15 to $20.
Okay.
The Farrah Fawcett poster is usually in about the $100 range. Anything Charlie's Angels with Farrah in it does pretty well. I sold a rare Denver TV Guide poster
with
Charlie's Angels with Farrah for about $80.
All right.
What was the Avellini?
That's my
couldn't
favorite.
Tell, especially on the Blue Ox. If it was like a signed
An Avellini 8x10, and that's pork different. Chops. They got a pork chop special. That's great.
And then what was a couple of other items?
45.
The 45. Oh, Super Bowl Shuffle. Yes, that. The 45 is probably only about $25. If you have the album like still in
the
shrink,
yeah,
it could be open as long as the shrink's on there. That can go as high as like $50-$55, for the 12-inch.
All right. Well, keep going.
Yep. Thanks calling,
Jefferson.
Again.
All right. Jim, what do you want to brag about, Jim?
Well, actually, one of my treasured items, my favorite T-shirt. It's a Leonard Cohen from when he was here in concert with his original artwork, a portrait of himself with the logo. It was the hat after all. I'd say it's from maybe 10 years ago. It's like a pea green thing, sort of a fluorescent portrait that he did of himself.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'm not finding that.
So that's a T-shirt.
Yeah, it's a T-shirt from his show when he was here in Chicago.
Do you wear it all the time, or is it just like
I wear it pretty. It's actually a well-made shirt, and it's very comfortable. I wouldn't sell it, but I thought, well, you know, because of his passing and the body of work he did, I thought, well, I just and I was enjoying your show as we were.
No, you're absolutely right.
Coming. Home in the car, so
I like that shirt. Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't find the first shirt you're discussing, but his other shirts tend to be in the $15 range. But I'm sure that shirt is much
more. But still, I like it. I like the Leonard Cohen shirt. That you got to get good compliments on that. I bet.
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah. People really notice it because it's sort of fluorescent. Yeah. And the eyes are like they sort of glow. So anyway, great show.
Awesome.
Enjoyed it very much.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Sure. Bye.
312-981-7200. Having fun tonight on Swap Meet with Greg Flamm. All right. Let's do David, and then we'll take a break. David, what do you want to brag about, David?
Hey, what's going on? What's up? So I've got a Thomas Jones jersey.
Classic.
Okay.
But it's got Lance Briggs, Chris Harris, and Sean Gale's signature on it.
Okay.
How do you get Sean Gale? He's not the wrong generation. He's just hanging out at the. He's just hanging out where the other guys are hanging out.
Yeah, I was at actually at a bar with some coworkers and actually buying me the jersey for a Christmas present, and the three of them are in the bar together and they signed it.
What? That's okay. Awesome. Was it downtown or was it like in a neighborhood?
Downtown is like in UIC area, Halsted and Maxwell.
I love it. They're just hanging out.
Wow,
it's just where the Bears hang out, Taylor Street.
Yeah, this was probably in 2007, 2008.
Yeah, right around the Super Bowl, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't find any solds, but one just Thomas Jones signed jersey is like $80, they're asking.
That's a shame.
That doesn't mean it's going to get that, but yeah.
At least.
But with the other signatures, maybe a little bit more, 150 maybe.
You talk to any of those guys, you know, David, you talk to any of those Bears at the time, like if you get to Urlacher or Briggs or hear an interview, they will say that the reason they did not win more is because they traded Thomas Jones.
Yep.
I agree.
Because they invested in Cedric Benson and they dropped Thomas Jones.
The wrong running back.
Yep, yeah, they picked the wrong running back. That'll be the name of his memoir. The wrong running back. One. David, thanks for the call.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, 312-981-7200, having fun tonight with Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll read your texts. We got a lot of them tonight, so I'll kind of go rapid fire, and we'll get through to the rest of the calls here in Swap Meet. Stay with us. It's a Swap Meet here, 312-981-7200, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Greg Flamm with me at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. All right, let's get back to it. We got some great people on the line. Let's go to Tom. Tom, what do you want to brag about, Tom?
I have a popcorn thing from 1959 with Minnie Minoso's signature on it.
What? Okay. What do you mean a popcorn? So you're like you got it at the
remember
game?
The,
you just
remember the little quarter popcorn things they used to have?
Yeah.
And you have a go 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 on the outside with Louis Aparicio and Nellie Fox. Okay. I have his signature on that popcorn machine.
Wow, that's
on that
great.
Popcorn thing.
That's wild. Yeah.
I don't know what that's worth, but that's awesome. That's a great thing to brag about. That's how you get it. Right. By the way, that is how you get an autograph. Mess around with this. We do a swap meet. Everybody's like, oh, I got an autograph, and it's on perfectly placed. Right. And no, you take whatever garbage is in your hand, and you get it signed.
Right. I also have Tom McGraw, who used to be a first baseman, and Floyd Robinson, who used to be an outfielder.
Yeah, Floyd Robinson, of course.
Yeah, and then the other side, I have Rip Collins from the Cubs.
He's got them all. I love it.
Wow, yeah, you're loaded. Yeah. The
Mini
Minoso.
And in 1972 baseball with all the White Sox signed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Mini Minoso, because he signed so much stuff, his signature isn't worth as much as it should. You would think it would be. You can find signed baseballs.
I also have Jim Harbaugh's signature, too, on a photograph of himself.
Oh, man, all right. Well, thanks, Tom. Thanks for all the signatures.
Yeah. You got
a bunch. Good job getting them, I guess. Robert, what do you got? What do you want to brag about, Robert?
I found this yesterday at Mom's house, and I remember I was punished. Because I couldn't have it. I don't know what. I was a bad kid.
Okay.
I
wasn't a bad kid. You were a bad kid.
But I have Ray Raider's signature, signature.
Wow.
On the duck box.
Oh, nice.
Garfield Goose.
Yeah.
Garfield Goose box.
Yeah,
with
Garfield that's
so good.
In it.
Not open.
Not opened?
Not open.
Wow. So was this given to you as a toy and then you were bad and they're like, you'll never have it. Then you found it later and you're like, wow, I never played with this.
That's crazy.
I found it yesterday.
Nice.
I'm cleaning out Mom's basement and there it is. And I'm like, damn. But it's actually signed by him. And then there's a photograph behind it with my mom, Ray Raynor. And then I think it's my aunt. And you know, so it's like.
That's amazing. That's really cool. Yeah.
It's not for sale. I was just curious.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously there's not much to compare that to online. I'm finding obviously just some regular pictures that aren't signed for $5, but nothing really signed. So if you were to sell it, you know, you kind of
I just feel like
the
Garfield Goose in a box that was never played with, signed by Ray Raynor, that's got to be worth a lot.
Yeah.
I would think it is. The Chicago in me says yes.
Well, yeah, and it's all Chicago. It's all WPN.
Yeah, right.
And then I helped her next door neighbor, and I found an old Wurlitzer jukebox.
Wow.
And I don't know how old it is, but it does have, nothing's broken on it. It's got to be, I'm going to say, a good 5 feet tall.
Wow.
I mean, and it is a Wurlitzer because I checked it.
Okay.
I mean, wow. I'm like you guys. I find all kinds of crap.
I love it. Yeah.
I do. I found a 1969 AMC Javelin.
Wow.
In a barn up in the
Did you say a Javelin?
Javelin, yeah.
Like the an AMC thing Javelin. Yeah. It still ran. I still own it.
There you go.
Wow. So, I mean, that's got to, you know. Javelins.
Thanks, Robert. Thanks, buddy.
You bet.
First Javelin on the swap meet.
Yeah, we haven't heard that. Heard many other cars, but not that.
Not too many Javelins. All right, so let's go quick here because I only got about 2 minutes left.
Okay.
I apologize to everyone that if we don't get to you tonight. 630 has an awesome classic concert vintage tees. He's got 9 Prince T-shirts from the Minneapolis Glam Slam days.
Wow.
7 Bowie T-shirts, 1 Glenn Frey, 2 Greg Allman, 3 Tom Petty.
Yeah,
a lot there. I mean,
some of the Prince T-shirts are going upwards of $400.
Wow!
And I would think the early, you know, glam slam days or whatever.
Is there going to be a run on Tom Petty stuff?
I would think so. Sadly, but yeah, you know,
yeah. 773 has a shirt signed by the remaining members of the Grateful Dead.
Mm-hmm. That was a big one. A different shirt. I'm sure it's not the same shirt, but went for like $3,000, a signed one.
What?
Yeah, and
what?
I couldn't find many others that were signed by like the whole band or everyone other than Jerry Garcia.
All right,
so
that's cool. All right, one more. Let's do Frank, and then we'll close it out. Frank, what do you want to brag about, Frank?
Muhammad Ali signature on a piece of paper.
Okay.
And Duke Ellington.
Wow.
And also. James Garner, who was
the trifecta.
Wow.
From 1960 when I
there
was
there. You go. You got all the greats.
That
Ali,
is a random trifecta.
Ellington and Garner.
Yes.
See, that's like, wow. I feel like there should be like a ding, 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 like a bell that goes off. You got all three.
Yep.
So what does a James Garner autograph go for?
I don't know, but Duke Ellington is going for about 140 to 300,
wow,
depending
that's
what
awesome,
it's on.
Man. Can you imagine?
But James Garner, that's going to be rough.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
All right, there you go. That's awesome. Frank.
What about Muhammad Ali?
I would think that there's a lot of Muhammad Ali out what do I know, you know?
Yeah, but you're still probably in the 50 to 150 range, depending what was signed. If it's just a piece of paper, you know, you might be in the $50 range, $60.
Sounds like a haul, though.
Mm-hmm.
Good, the trifecta. Thanks, Frank.
All right. What about a record on by Billie Holiday, autographed record, a 78.
I love that.
78. Do you happen to know the title of it?
No, but it's in the Bluebell or Bluebird label. It's one of those breakable if you drop it once.
Right.
Yeah, right. All right, we'll look for it. Ththanks, Frank.
Yep.
All right. 981-7200. Thanks, everyone, for playing tonight. It's amazing to me. There's so much stuff, and every week I say it. You know, I'm like, you guys were humbled by everybody wanting to participate in the segment, and there's so many texts that are on there, and I can't get to them, and also calls that are on the line. So next week, we'll be back here doing the swap meet, so get in a little bit earlier, and we'll try to get you in and answer your texts and your calls. Greg Flamm, you can find him both at Facebook and Twitter, @DuPagePicker. He joins us every Wednesday for the swap meet. Greg, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Justin.